Stealing ain't right, especially from women.
Then we're gonna have to put you to work, stud.
Two outsiders searching for connection.
You're a thief, right?
So yeah, I am, but you ain't got nothing worth stealing, so what are you worried about?
Midnight Cowboy begins on Sunday at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 21st of August. This is Today with Simon Jack in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines today, the Met Office is warning that the El Niño weather event is gathering strength at an unprecedented pace, heightening the risk of more extreme wet weather around the world. With the UK set for a wet, stormy autumn, what can we do to avert the risk of flooding after a long, hot summer? Reports say the Duchess of Sussex will return to acting after being offered a role based in the UK. But who will foot the bill for the Sussex's security? The Prime Minister says that question is a private matter.
Also in today's programme, who's winning the war in Ukraine? As the country counts the cost of devastating Russian strikes this week, can President Zelensky hold out without access to crucial Patriot missiles? We'll speak to the Polish Foreign Minister. It's one of the most infamous goals in the history of football.
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee. And the goal is given. A use of the hand that England are complaining about.
40 years on from Diego Maradona's hand of God goal against England in the 1986 World Cup, the ball from that match is up for sale. But why are we still so fascinated by that moment? And
it is a wonderful thing for our businessmen and our manufacturers and our unemployed to taste hope again. But they must not allow anyone to put them back in the gold cage where they have been pining their hearts out all these years.
A new play examining the life, loves and legacy of the economist John Maynard Keynes is opening this week. We'll speak to the actor Rory Kinnear about portraying one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century and beyond. Before all of that, the BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
The Met Office is warning that a developing El Niño weather system is set to become the strongest in living memory, possibly since the 19th century. Forecasters say that combined with climate change, the phenomenon could result in next year being the hottest in recorded history. El Niño is a recurring climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which sees unusually warm waters boost the risk of extreme weather around the world. More details from our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Met Office is warning sea temperatures in the central tropical Pacific could rise more than 3 degrees above normal in the coming months. That is far beyond the range of a typical El Niño. That matters because El Niño can shift weather patterns across the globe. Central America, tropical South America and parts of Australia are among the regions at increased risk of drought. In the Atlantic, El Niño tends to suppress hurricanes. The Met Office says the event could increase the chances of wetter, stormier conditions across northwest Europe, including the UK, this autumn and early winter. It is also likely to push up global temperatures, which is why the Met Office said today that 2027 was very likely to overtake 2024 as the warmest year on record.
The Panama Canal Authority has announced restrictions on marine traffic through one of the world's most important waterways because of drought conditions fuelled by El Niño. The number of vessels allowed to sail through will be cut in stages through September due to low water levels in artificial lakes that feed the canal. The operator has already reduced the maximum depth in the water for the largest ships. The Home Office says French police officers have stopped 185 small boats from crossing the Channel in the first 3 months of a new deal with Paris. Citing data from the authorities in France, the government says new tactics, including the deployment of a 50-strong riot squad, prevented more than 4,300 migrants from making the journey. Despite the increased enforcement activity, more than 8,000 people came to Britain on small boats over the same period. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
The government signed a new deal with France in April, paying more than £600 million for tougher policing on the other side of the Channel. Officials say more boat equipment is now being seized on the way to the coast. More dinghies are being intercepted and punctured on the beaches. And for the first time, they're being stopped at sea, regarded as a safety risk in the past. Three boats were prevented from entering British waters in the last 2 weeks, having left the French coast. 61% of crossing attempts have been intercepted, but that's an increase of only 5% compared with the same period last year. The Conservatives said they would refuse asylum claims to small boat migrants, a policy which would mean leaving the European Convention on Human Rights.
The first National Day for Survivors of Terrorism in the UK will be marked by a ceremony in London this afternoon. Campaigners have welcomed the event, but a new report is warning that some survivors are being badly let down. Here's Our Society reporter Guy Lambert.
Today's ceremony coincides with the UN's International Day of Remembrance and is expected to focus on recognising those affected by acts of terror, encouraging survivors to access specialist support and raising awareness of how the public can help prevent future attacks. Travis Fane, who was injured in the Westminster Bridge attack in 2017, has campaigned for the National Day. He says it will ensure victims and survivors are not forgotten. But a report by the group Survivors Against Terror says those caught up in incidents are still being let down, particularly when it comes to immediate financial assistance and progress on a state compensation fund.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been returned to prison after a court-ordered visit to a hospital in Islamabad. His lawyers say his health has deteriorated. The Pakistani government says a team of doctors carried out a detailed examination of Mr. Khan and declared him medically fit. Mr. Khan has spent 3 years in jail on corruption charges that his supporters say are politically motivated. Sources close to the Sussex family have not denied reports that Meghan has been offered an acting role in the UK. No details have been confirmed. Harry and Meghan are set to move into a private residence away from London within days. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The Duchess of Sussex put her acting career on hold after her marriage to Prince Harry. But reports in Australian media say she is going back to acting with a role in a UK-based entertainment project. And this is one of the reasons why the Sussex family is leaving America. Harry and Meghan's representatives are not denying the story, but aren't giving any details at this stage. As an actress, she was best known for her part in the US legal drama Suits, where she played Rachel Zane, a lawyer, for 7 seasons.
What's arguably the most famous football in history has gone up for auction in the United States. Bidding is underway for the ball used in the 1986 World Cup clash between England and Argentina, when Diego Maradona scored 2 unforgettable goals. Here's our sports correspondent, Katie Gornall.
It remains one of sport's most enduring images. Diego Maradona hanging in the air to punch the ball past Peter Shilton during Argentina's World Cup quarter-final against England. The handball was missed by the referee, and the Argentina playmaker later said it was scored a little with the head of Maradona and a little with the hand of God. 4 minutes later, the same ball ended up in the net again, this time through a superb individual effort from Maradona, later voted the goal of the century. Now it's up for auction in Texas. Online bidding, which started at $2.5 million, closes on the 23rd of August.
Katie Gornall reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. 6:07. Let us get our first look at the weather this morning with Thomas Schaffernacker at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Thomas.
And a very good morning to you. It's going to be a pretty decent day, I think, for most of us. Yesterday, we had quite a few showers, even some thunderstorms. And I mean, I know we'd like more showers because it's so dry. But I think the weather is going to be pretty quiet for many of us. At the moment, there are some clear spells, sunny spells eventually developing in many parts of the country. It's a little fresh. Fresh too, 9 degrees in the north of the UK, 13 in the south, and this is what we're going to get this afternoon. So starting with Scotland, sunny spells expected in northern and central areas. It is going to be a predominantly dry day. In Northern Ireland, we're also expecting some sunny spells, very few showers around, and both in Scotland and Northern Ireland, temperatures this afternoon should peak at around 17 Celsius in some of our bigger towns and cities. Moving on to Wales, some sunshine around the north of Wales, but at times it will cloud over in the south. That means that the Brecon Beacons could catch a few showers, and here temperatures will be hovering around about 20 Celsius, for example, in Swansea and Cardiff. Now over to the rest of England now. In the north of England, there could be showers anywhere from the northeast through parts of Yorkshire into Lincolnshire, perhaps even into East Anglia. But I think they won't be as heavy as they were yesterday and not as thundery. Elsewhere across England, I think predominantly dry weather with some sunny spells along the south coast of England. And the temperatures across England will vary from 22 in London to about 17 Celsius in Newcastle. And the weekend is looking drier with high pressure building back.
Good to hear. Thank you, Thomas. It is 9 minutes past six now. Let's take a look at the morning's papers. And the drama of Prince Harry's return to the UK after 6 years in California dominates the front pages today. The Daily Telegraph says he hopes to win back the King's trust, partly with a promise to stop publicly discussing private family matters. The King will put William first, suggests the Times, which believes his heir and the institution will remain Charles's priority. The Sun says there'll be a Royal Harry summit at Balmoral, as the Daily Mirror concludes there's no way back to royal life for the Sussexes. Back in the fold, but not in the firm, is how the Daily Express puts it. In 15 pages of coverage, the Daily Mail recalls the parable of the prodigal son and says it's too soon to say how Harry's return will shape the future of the House of Windsor.
The Guardian says the Equalities Minister, Bridget Phillipson, believes racism and sexism have become normalised in Britain, with young men being sucked into violent misogyny by a social media cesspit. She tells the paper's podcast things that not very long ago felt totally unacceptable are becoming normal.
The Times quotes the head of the exams regulator Ofqual as saying that reforms introduced by the former Education Secretary Michael Gove have turned England into a maths powerhouse. The paper reports that strong maths results in yesterday's GCSEs were dragged down by older teenagers taking resits, highlighting, the Times says, a widening gap between the most and the least academic.
The I paper says there's a bitter power struggle engulfing Nigel Farage's top team over the future of Reform's UK Home Affairs spokesman Zia Yusuf. The paper says that if he crashes out of the party for a second time, some members could follow him. The only interesting thing about Reform UK at the moment, according to the sketch writer John Crace in The Guardian, is that they're fighting like rats in a sack.
And Britain was drenched by downpours yesterday, says The Sun. Oh, you might have experienced it yourself. You don't necessarily need to read it in the papers this morning. It reports, though, The Sun today on water bosses warning that that long-awaited deluge will do nothing to ease the worst drought for 50 years. Picturing women arriving for Ladies' Day at York Races, the Daily Express says the umbrellas went up as the drizzle came down under the headline, "Don't rain on my parade."
Very nearly 12 minutes past six.
Today is the first National Day for Victims and Survivors of Terrorism. A ceremony is being held in London, but it will move around the country each year. And to coincide with the event, a new report is warning that survivors of attacks don't always get the support that they need. Well, Nick Johnson, our correspondent, is looking at this. And before, Nick, we talk about that particular report and what it's found and what it's calling for, just tell us about the event today and what people are hoping it will bring.
Yeah, I think it's a space, first of all, for people who have been affected by terror attacks to come together, to share in each other's stories, share in each other's grief, trauma and experiences. There are going to be victims and families at this event later from all sorts of attacks, from the 7/7 attacks, the Bali bombings, the Manchester Arena attack. And it really is a chance for those people to get together and create that space. There will be, as you say, this will start in London this year, but then the idea is that this event will move around the country in subsequent years. People there will be encouraged to post their memories and stories on social media. And there'll be a space for a couple of minutes silence as well. But I think the additional motivation for today is to remind people of the ongoing threat posed by terror attacks. Of course, that the UK's terror threat level was raised to severe in May. So I think this is also about encouraging people sort of to keep an eye on one another. And the message is that we all have a role to play in stopping terrorism.
And that report that we mentioned, Nick, says that in some cases, support for survivors is good, but there are elements that just don't basically deliver them what they need after being involved in something like that.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a report released by the group Survivors Against Terror, one of its co-founders, Brendan Cox, who's the husband of the murdered Labour MP, Joe Cox. They say that some of the support offered to victims of terror, such as immediate psychological support, well, that has been praised. But there's a couple of areas of support that have really fallen short in their point of view, and that is primarily financial support. They criticised, Survivors Against Terror criticised the state compensation scheme, which is the Criminal Injuries Compensation Authority, for having no particular arena for victims of terror. And they say that compensation scheme needs to be overhauled. It provides an example of a man who suffered horrendous injuries at the Manchester Arena attack, trying to go about applying for compensation and having to relive the trauma of that night over and over again when applying for that compensation with very little compassion. So it's about overhauling that particular system. Brendan Cox says that they're not talking about huge amounts of money that people are claiming for, but it's all part of victims' dignity. We've heard from someone who survived the Fishmongers Hall attack in 2019 in London that some members of their group, they don't have the resources to overhaul their homes following the attacks that have left them struggling to walk. Now, the Ministry of Justice, which is responsible for that the compensation scheme in its current iteration, says that £180 million was paid out just last year for all types of violent crime. And of course, that does include terrorism.
Nick, thank you. Nick Johnson, our correspondent there. We will speak to one of the authors of that report after seven on the programme this morning.
Now, as we were hearing the headlines, Imran Khan, former Prime Minister of Pakistan, cricket legend, of course, and since 2023 prison inmate, was admitted to hospital overnight due to poor health. Carrie Davis is the BBC's correspondent in Pakistan. And Carrie, we think he's now back in prison. What can you tell us?
Yeah, so this came about because there was a court order from the Supreme Court here in Pakistan on Tuesday. They said that having seen a recent health report about Imran Khan, which included things like fluctuating blood pressure, anxiety, palpitations, that he needed to be assessed by doctors in a particular hospital here in Islamabad called the Shifa International Hospital. And they directed that he had to be relocated there to be assessed by a panel of doctors. Now, there was a lot of back and forth about when that was exactly going to happen. And late last night, we anticipated that Imran Khan was meant to arrive at this hospital. We stood outside it for a long time. We'd actually heard from his political party that he had come to the hospital and was inside, but we never got confirmation from the authorities that that had happened. This morning, we have now heard that Imran Khan was transferred back to prison. And in fact, in the last few minutes, we've just heard from the information minister here in Pakistan that, in fact, he didn't go to that particular hospital. He went to a different one altogether. So still a lot of confusion about exactly what happened last night. There was also anticipation that Imran Khan would be staying in the hospital for several days at least. Some anticipated until midway through September when his next court hearing is due to happen. But instead, he was in and out within a matter of hours. And so there is a lot of confusion about exactly what has happened here in Islamabad overnight. The reason this is considered to be particularly significant is, as you say, Imran Khan has been in prison for just over 3 years. And during that time, he's been given very little relief by the court system. So the fact that this had happened was being seen as quite a new stage for Imran Khan. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people speculating, is there something going on with political manoeuvrings behind the scenes? So still a lot of confusion about that this morning.
Okay. Carrie, thank you very much. Carrie Davis there in Pakistan.
17 minutes past six, the cost of long-term US government borrowing has continued to rise because, well, investors are still uneasy about the scale of its debt pile. Will Baines got more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Morning, Will.
Morning, Anna. Yeah, and a bit about what it might mean for us here in the UK too, on a morning, of course, where the ONS will give us a snapshot of our own debt picture a little later on, which we'll be chatting about on the programme. Judith McKenzie is with us, partner and head of Downing Fund Managers, to try and pick through this morning, Judith.
Good morning, Will.
And we've talked about it a couple of times during the week already, haven't we? But I think it's worth again just go back the rationale then from the White House's perspective as to why Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, chose to step in earlier in the week.
Yeah, let's just wind back a bit there. So just looking at the debt levels in the US at the moment, they're $40 trillion. And that's the highest they've actually ever been. And that's made investors in bonds and US debt a little bit nervous. And actually what we've seen is that the 30-year bond has gone up to highest levels. The yield has gone up to highest levels that it has been for quite some time. And it's peaked over 5%. So Bessent stepped in and said that they were going to start buying back some bonds, about $4 billion worth of bonds, to try and get that gilt yield down. And that's quite a brave thing to do because it's a bit like putting your mortgage on your credit card. You're basically loading up with debt to buy your debt back to try and get the price of your debt down. And that sounds confusing because it is. So what happened on, I think it was Wednesday, he announced that, and the 30-year gilt yield came down, dropped to about 5.18%, which was good, but it was very brief, because yesterday they went back up on the 30-year, and they went back up to 5.23 to 5.25. So it really was, the intervention bought less than 24 hours of calm.
Yeah, so it was meant to buy some breathing room, evidently more breathing room than that. One investor telling the Financial Times this morning it was a band-aid on a bullet hole on its own. I mean, is it then the fact that the Iran war shows no sign of stopping, that the inflation worries? Is it the overall debt pile itself? Is it both? What is it that seems to be concerning people and is not being abated by these moves?
Well, I think we know, isn't it? Yeah, it's war, it's inflation, because war tends to lead to inflation because you're spending money on it. Then the debt, we just talked about the highest debt level in the US, but actually, if you look worldwide, we're running at the highest debt levels worldwide ever. And that then has an impact on the oil price, which has an impact on inflation. And then we start arguing over oil again, and we've got war. So, yes, it's all interlinked.
And in terms of being interlinked, we saw lots of countries' government borrowing rise, their gilt yields, their bond yields rise as a result of this too, including our own. So just talk people through the potential impacts on that from a government level right down to a household level.
Yes, look, you've got to remember, without getting too gloomy about it, we have seen quite a bit of volatility in oil prices and gilt yields over the course of this year because of the situation in the Gulf. So although it looks pretty grim at the moment in terms of gilt yields, then let's put some context into it. So they can bounce back, and Brent crude is trading around about $93 a barrel at the moment, and that was about up about 1.5% on the day and near about a 1 month high. But that can go back down as well as soon as you see ships going back through the Hormuz, the Straits. So what does it mean for us as consumers? If this is sustained, then it's likely that there will be further inflation, and that could lead to interest rates going up. So our cost of debt will get higher as well.
Judith McKenzie, partner and head of Downing Fund Managers, thanks so much for your time. Well, once one of the country's key engines for growth, the unravelling effects of China's property market, also, of course, revolving around debt since the pandemic, are still being felt today in the world's second largest economy. Evergrande, the real estate giant at the heart of that slump, a company we've talked about a few times on the programme, defaulted on its debts back in 2021, since collapsed and delisted from the Hong Kong Stock Exchange. And yesterday, extraordinary scenes, really. Its founder, a kind of true rags-to-riches story and longtime leader, was sentenced to life in prison for charges including embezzlement and bribery. Duncan Wrigley is the chief China economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics. Morning, Duncan.
Good morning, Will.
Kind of extraordinary, really, to see Hui Kaiyan, a man who'd been at just about every big state event in China, right? One of the kind of real new captains of business in China, in court, flanked by prison guards, and then sent to jail for life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Evergrande at one point was the biggest developer in China by some measurements in terms of floor area developed. At its peak, it had land that could be developed into, you know, more than 2 million apartments. So it's absolutely enormous. And to see this fall is staggering.
And the impact that that then had on the wider economy, not too much of a stretch, is it to say that it really has been the kind of beginning, middle and end of a lot of China's economic issues?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the property market was really one of the key engines of growth for more than two decades. And since the second half of 2021, it's been in this entrenched downturn, which has really just dragged on China's growth and made it rather subpar, especially coming after the pandemic. And it's had secondary impacts because real estate is the single largest source of people's wealth. So people are understandably reluctant to spend money, and that's dragging on consumption.
Yeah, that spillover has hit all sorts of things, hasn't it? You know, the shares of luxury goods manufacturers hit because sales in China have slumped. We heard a report from Diageo, didn't we, last week, the whiskey maker, about slumping sales there as well. Had a huge spillover into sort of the wider consumption section of the Chinese economy.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, China used to be a huge source of overseas tourism revenue with its people traveling abroad and spending voraciously in Europe, as you say, luxury goods stores, but across Southeast Asia. You know, that source of tourism revenue for other countries has started to come back, but nowhere near where it was before the pandemic.
And this sentence, the sort of stringentness of it, if you like, that presumably from the outside feels like that was meant to send a message, right, from the Chinese government to say, we assure you something like this will never happen again. Will it work, I suppose, to bring back confidence, particularly in the property sector first and then that wider confidence in spending, do you think?
It's going to be a long road to bring back confidence in the property sector. Yes, that this particular company and the way that it carried out fraud, inflating asset values, and this kind of thing, to in order to borrow money, you know, maybe that exact model won't be repeated again. But the property market is still bedeviled by difficulties. You know, the birth rate, as I'm sure you've reported on, is very low. Demand for property is very weak, and people still lack confidence in the direction of property prices. And so we still see it's going to be quite a few years, really, for the property market to start to get back on its feet.
Duncan, thanks so much for your time this morning. Duncan Wrigley, the chief China economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics there. Now, retail footfall has taken a hit from the hot weather and squeezed budgets so far this summer, but Majestic Wine, which runs more than 200 stores around the UK, is one of the businesses which is going all in on physical stores. Majestic making a £4 million investment in its bricks and mortar shops in the coming year, including opening at least four new locations. It's after another major commitment on the high street when Majestic acquired Vagabond wine bar chain in 2024, and a rescue deal plans to expand there as well. John Colley, the chief executive of Majestic, joins us now. Morning, John. We've had lots of doom and gloom, I guess, from retailers and hospitality in the last few, well, months really, on the programme. So what is it that you're doing, do you think, that's sort of bucking that trend and being in expansion mode?
Morning, Will. Well, look, Majestic's been on an interesting trajectory for the last 5 or 6 years. And we made a commitment following the acquisition of Fortress to that retail experience of having bricks and mortar. So I think we're at store number 18. We opened a store last week. So it's kind of very important for our overall proposition for our customers to have that physical experience. So it's kind of not new news for us. And we still know that there's places in the UK where we could put down a really nice shop.
Yeah, well, where you're putting them is always interesting as well. You've kind of shifted a little bit to meet what the kind of changes in commuting patterns, I guess. Is that shifting again as we see that sort of balance between home and office work tilt backwards and forwards?
Not particularly. I mean, you know, we've opened stores in places like, you know, Beaconsfield, you know, Heartland Market Towns, where obviously a Majestic would do really well. But there's lots of little white spaces all across the UK that, you know, we've tried smaller format stores. We've got a small one in Harpenden and also one in Marlow. But the data that Majestic holds on its system, data we've been collecting for decades, kind of tells us where customers are, you know, which shopping method they prefer, whether it's online or whether like a physical experience. So the data that we have in Majestic gives us this kind of superpower to be able to really establish where we should be putting down our shops.
And in terms of then what helps you to continue to grow, what are you looking at in the second half of the year?
Well, second half of this year is obviously about Christmas for Majestic. It's a really important period. We take a lot of money over that period for us. So, you know, I think team's really geared up for that. We've got another store that's going to be opening in London later this year as well. So the teams are all geared up for that and getting some great product for our customers.
Yeah, and reading a growth in English wine, really. You're seeing a big demand for that. Has that not been a passing phase? That's growing, is it, as a sector?
I don't think it's a passing phase. I think it's growing. There's a lot more investment going into it. It's still quite small, but growing quite quickly. English sparkling has always been pretty strong, but we're now seeing that in still wine, and that's an area that we try and support. Actually, Vagabond, we opened Europe's largest urban winery in Canada Water. So we actually produce our own English wine, which is award-winning, and we distribute that through our bars and also through our stores.
John Colley, Chief Executive at Majestic Wine, thanks so much for your time.
And thank you, Will. Let's get some sport with Mike Williams. Mike, cricket to start with.
Yes, morning, Simon. England's cricketers remain on top against Pakistan in the first test at Headingley. They closed day two yesterday on 366 for eight. That is a first innings lead of 195. With more on yesterday's action, here's Eleanor Oldroyd.
Only half a day's cricket possible because of the weather, but enough time for England to build an imposing lead with two century partnerships and half centuries for four batters. Jordan Cox made his maiden test 50, scoring 73 in a partnership of 150 with Joe Root, who was out for 66 in his 66th game as England captain. After they both fell quickly, Harry Brook and Dan Lawrence tightened England's grip on the game, putting on 120 together. Returning after 2 years out, Lawrence made 51 and Brook was furious with himself when he fell in sight of his century for 91. Even under the floodlights, Pakistan's seamers were unthreatening, although left-arm spinner Ali Usman became the third bowler in the game to take a fifer. England will resume on day three with a lead of 195 and two wickets left.
And you can follow day three on Test Match Special, which begins over on BBC Sounds from 10:25 this morning. Next to football, and lots of British clubs involved in Europa Conference League playoff ties last night. There were first leg victories for Rangers and Larne. Brighton, Hearts and Hibs all had to settle for a draw, however, and there was defeat for Motherwell. See all those scores on the BBC Sport website. Meanwhile, Rory McIlroy has the clubhouse lead after the first round of the BMW Championship in the USA. The world number two finished 6 under par in Missouri. Whilst in tennis, the defending champion Carlos Alcaraz is set to make his return at next week's US Open after missing 4 months with a wrist problem. The 23-year-old won the Australian Open back in January to become the youngest man to win all four Grand Slam titles. However, the Spaniard has not played a competitive match since the 14th of April after injury at the Barcelona Open. Meanwhile, the US Open will offer the biggest prize fund in Grand Slam history, with a total of £79 million on offer. That marks a 20% increase from last year. Here's Russell Fuller.
The singles champions this year will receive a relatively meagre 10% increase to $5.5 million, which is just over 4 million quid. The biggest increases are reserved for those in the early rounds. And I remember Jessica Pegula, the world number three, talking to her at Indian Wells in March, and she was saying, well, last year's prize money increase was fantastic, but it was primarily devoted to those who reached the second week.
Yes, that works out as a 27% increase in prize money for first round losers at the US Open this year. Players who fail to make the second round will take home almost £103,000, which is up by more than £22,000 from last year. Finally, racing, and the Ebor Festival continues with day three at York later this afternoon. We have two tips for you there. The first in the 3:35, number 12, Asfurah, and then in the 4:10, we go with number 15, Primo Lara.
Good stuff. Beautifully pronounced as well, Mike, for this time of the morning. Very impressive. Now, let's look ahead to tomorrow, which we are starting off on a harmonious note.
Wild Mountain Time has always been a favourite of mine.
The new series of Soul Music on BBC Radio 4.
It's an expression of love. We don't know what tomorrow holds.
Pieces of music that touch people's lives.
The song, you know, composed by Edvard Grieg, is one of the national treasures of Norway.
Suddenly you get this da da da, and you get this impulse.
Soul Music continues on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
And we recognise that one. We'll be singing along to Neil Diamond tomorrow morning in Soul Music at 10:30. I am told you are, it is now 27 minutes to 7. You're listening today with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The Met Office is warning that a developing El Niño weather system in the Pacific Ocean could be the biggest since the 19th century, making it very likely that 2027 will be the hottest year on record. The forecaster says this could also bring wetter and stormier conditions to the UK this autumn and early winter. The Panama Canal Authority is introducing restrictions on marine traffic through one of the world's most important waterways because of drought conditions fuelled by El Niño. The number of vessels allowed to sail through will be reduced in stages through September. The Home Office says French police officers have prevented 185 small boats from crossing the Channel in the 3 months after a new deal was signed with Paris in April. Despite the increased enforcement activity, more than 8,000 people came to Britain on small boats over the same period. The UK is having its first National Day for Victims and Survivors of Terrorism, marked by a ceremony in London. Travis Frayne was injured in the Westminster Bridge attack in 2017 and says it will ensure victims of acts of terror are not forgotten. But a report by the group Survivors Against Terror warns they're being let down by a lack of support and compensation. Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been returned to prison after receiving medical attention in hospital under a Supreme Court order. The Pakistani government said a team of doctors had conducted a detailed examination of Mr. Khan and declared him medically fit. Reports in Australian media say the Duchess of Sussex is returning to acting and has secured a role in the UK. Meghan's team are not denying the claims. The Sussex family are moving to England from California in the next few weeks as private citizens.
Caroline, thank you. 25 minutes to seven. The weather this year, excuse me, has never been far from the news. And now the Met Office are telling us we are entering one of the most dramatic demonstrations of the El Niño phenomenon in a very long time. Justin Rowlett is our climate editor. And Justin, what I hadn't quite appreciated is we're not pegging the recent hot weather we've had to El Niño. This is something new that's starting. What is it and what are the consequences?
So what is El Niño? Are you ready for a lesson in very basic meteorology, Simon?
Go ahead.
Normally, the trade winds blow in the Pacific from east to west. So the surface water, the water warmed by the sun, kind of piles up in the western Pacific off the coast of Indonesia and Australia. So the pattern is eastern Pacific is cold, west is warm. Winds blow from cold to hot. Cold areas have lower pressure, the cold air sinks. Warm areas have a higher pressure, the warm air rises. And that's why you get those trade winds established. Then occasionally, natural disturbances in tropical weather create bursts of westerly blowing wind, and that pushes some of the westerly warm water into the center of the Pacific, and that breaks down that temperature difference that drives the trade winds. So the winds get weaker, more warm water piles up in the central and eastern Pacific, and sometimes on really strong El Niño events, the winds start to blow the other way. So the pattern is reversed, and you get the warmer surface water piling up against the eastern Pacific. That is an El Niño event. And what happens is that additional warm water, that warmer water, I should say, delivers a kind of blast of heat and moisture to the atmosphere. And weather is, Simon, heat and moisture, as we've just been learning. And therefore, that ripples around the world, causing disruptions to weather patterns across the entire world.
And this particular year, we're seeing a much more dramatic, much more pronounced version of this phenomenon.
Exactly. So they're looking at that area of the Central Pacific where, you know, if the typical normal wind patterns break down, you see warming. And they're saying, I mean, and this is very strong language from the Met Office. I mean, this is a very kind of cautious, conservative organization. And just look at the language they're using. Unprecedented event, they're saying. Largest in living memory, they're saying this could be the largest since the 19th century. So they're looking at that middle area of the tropical Pacific. They say typically an El Niño event, you'd see a rise of between 1 and 2 degrees. In that area, 2 degrees being a kind of big El Niño. Mm. They're saying the forecast that they're making is suggesting it could go to 3 degrees or even higher. So they're saying the heat signal in the center of the Pacific is suggesting a very strong El Niño event. And as we've discussed, that then has a kind of ripple across the world. Droughts in Central America, tropical South America, Southern Africa and northeastern Australia. Mm. The Indian monsoon, the Met Office says, is already running lower rainfall than normal as a result of El Niño. You get less hurricanes. And here, people are wondering, what does it mean for us? Here in Northwest Europe, including the UK, we're likely to get, I mean, we're a long way from the Pacific, so it's kind of indirect here, but typically you'd see an increased chance for wetter, stormier autumn and earlier winter here.
Okay, Justin, thank you, I think. Justin Rowlett there, our climate editor. And we'll get the head of long-range forecasting at the Met Office just after 7 o'clock to give us more detail on what it could mean here in the UK.
It's 22 minutes to seven now. As Prince Harry and Meghan prepare their return to the UK, the Duke will be in the headlines again for a different reason later. He and other high-profile claimants who lost their privacy case against the Daily Mail will find out how much they'll have to pay in legal costs. It is likely to run into millions of pounds. Well, Helena Wilkinson, our royal correspondent, joins us from outside Windsor Castle. In a way, Helena, these two things are linked because one of the reasons that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex left the UK, they talked about privacy and security concerns, and this big court case against Associated Newspapers was all part of that.
Yes, Prince Harry has made it extremely clear over the years his anger at some sections of the media. And one of the reasons, as you say, Anna, for them leaving the UK and going to California. So he will be returning in a couple of weeks with his family. Later on today, as you've mentioned, we are going to get what's called a costs judgment following a costs hearing at the end of July, which I attended. It's all to do with their failed legal battle, Prince Harry and other high-profile claimants against Associated Newspapers Limited, the publisher of the Daily Mail. What we're going to find out later on today is how much the claimants will have to initially pay to the Daily Mail's publisher in legal costs. The ANL, the publisher, is seeking around £10 million as an initial cost. We heard at the hearing in July that the claimants will have to pay that by the 28th of August. The claimants argued in court in July that they thought the interim payment should be just over £7.9 million. And then what we're going to hear in the judgment from the judge this afternoon is how much more costs ANL will be able to claim. Will they be able to claim costs on what's called an indemnity rather than a standard basis? An indemnity basis would mean it will be more favourable to the publisher, ANL, in terms of the amount it can recover. But one thing is clear, the claimants will end up having to pay millions of pounds in costs to Associated Newspapers Limited after that failed legal battle, high-profile case.
There's another court battle worth mentioning this morning, Helena, as well, again, because it's related to their return to the UK. And that is the one that Prince Harry fought for security to be provided, taxpayer-funded security to he and his family. And that, again, is something that people are looking at as the family prepares to return to this country.
Yes, it's a big question that is being asked following that announcement by the family that they will be returning to the UK. Prince Harry was angered after his security provisions were downgraded after his return to the when he went to the US from the UK. Now that they are returning, there are questions about how their security, how that will look. We don't have many answers around that, but it's not clear at this stage whether taxpayers will end up footing the bill. The Whitehall Committee, RAVIC, which looks at assesses security arrangements for royalty and VIPs, they will likely have to relook at Harry's security. He is the son of the king, and they may now decide to give him levels of taxpayer-funded protection that he always wanted. But again, questions remain about how that is all going to look.
Helena Wilkinson, our royal correspondent, thank you. Actually, we'll explore some of those questions with a former head of royal protection after 7 o'clock here on the programme.
Now, are the French authorities getting better at stopping small boat crossings? The Home Office appears to think so. Damien Grammaticus is our political correspondent. Morning, Damien. What have the Home Office been saying?
Well, what they're saying is that since April, 185 potential crossings have been stopped. That's about two-thirds of all attempts. And April is critical because that's when the Home Office signed a new deal with France, £500 million over 3 years to fund operations on French beaches, more money for what are called new approaches. And some of that, the French have been saying, involves them stopping boats at sea. So something they have been reluctant to do before because of the safety implications. But a dozen boats, they say, have been stopped this summer. So the Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, saying that deal is having a real impact. The opposition from the Conservatives, Reform UK, they say that this is a joke. They say that the only real way to stop crossings is to deport people who arrive, prevent them from claiming asylum. Reform UK, remember a few weeks ago, saying that they would deploy the Royal Navy to drop migrants back on French beaches. Different approach from the Liberal Democrats. They say that Reform, the Conservatives, are the architects of this problem because of Brexit, meant all cooperation with the EU was lost. They want to go back into or join the EU's new Migration Asylum Pact. Andy Burnham, just over the summer, I mean, he was saying that he would be relentless. He understood people wanted the borders to be controlled, but also to help those genuinely in need, and the government would be working to do all of those things.
Damien, thank you. Thanks for that summary. Damien Grammaticus there.
16 minutes to 7. Israeli settlers have returned to the settlement of Kadim in the occupied West Bank 21 years after it was evacuated by a previous Israeli government. It is the last of four West Bank settlements dismantled in 2005 to be reopened under the current Israeli government, and it's part of a sprint to expand settlements across the West Bank before elections are held in Israel in October. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson has this report from outside Kadim.
Flanked by government ministers and rows of new white caravans, settler leader Yossi Dagan congratulated Kadim's new settler families as the inaugural ribbon was cut. "We've corrected the expulsion from northern Samaria," Dagan said, using the biblical name for the occupied West Bank, vowing that Jewish settlers would return to Gaza too. This area around Jenin is the latest focus of Israel's push to expand settlements across the West Bank. Government ministers and settler leaders were invited to Kadim's opening ceremony. Journalists were not. Down a narrow track just behind the settlement, we found a Palestinian vegetable farmer and his family. He asked us to hide his identity. As a boy, he told us he'd watched from this same house as the settlement of Kadim was built, then watched it evacuated two decades later. Now, he's watching the settlers return. This time it's different, he told me. Back then, the settlers lived alongside us. They lived their lives and we lived ours. But now, they already drove my nephews away from their citrus trees, telling them, you have no place here, don't come back. Kadim was one of four Israeli settlements forcibly evacuated in 2005. Israel's current government has reopened all four of them and approved more new settlements in the area as well, overturning a 20-year ban on Israeli settlers around Jenin. By the time caravans had arrived at the new settlement of Emek Dotan, Palestinian teacher Sama Jaba says the problems had already begun.
Settlers try to enter our homes and provoke us in every possible way. The biggest problem is after midnight. After midnight, they have powerful floodlights, and they stop right next to the house, shining them directly through the windows, house after house, until 2 or 3 in the morning.
Summer has watched the rapid growth in settlements and settler attacks in other parts of the West Bank, despite international pressure.
We are defenseless. Europe has no time for us. America is preoccupied with Iran. China has no interest. Russia is busy with Ukraine. The United Nations is finished. And the Arab countries have their own internal problems.
Alongside new settlements around Jenin are new Israeli military bases, including one near Jenin's refugee camp, the first permanent Israeli military site built on land under full Palestinian Authority control.
In the past, we enjoyed the bliss of not having settlements. Now, we live in a hell made by settlers and their attacks.
Kamal Abu al-Rab is the Palestinian Authority governor in Jenin.
It's as if the Israelis are racing against time before the upcoming elections. Many of the areas around the city are now surrounded by settlements. Farmers are afraid and anxious about settler attacks when they go to work on their lands. They have also cut off roads, bulldozed lands, and cut down trees.
This is the road that links the new settlement of Kadim to Israel.
The last time I was here, just a few weeks ago, we sat in a cafe over here drinking coffee, surrounded by Palestinian shops and businesses. Since then, dozens of those businesses have been flattened by the Israeli army. It gives you some sense of how fast things here are changing.
The countdown to Israeli elections in October, tallied here by the number of Palestinian buildings demolished, the number of new settler caravans.
That's Lucy Williamson reporting from outside Kadim in the occupied West Bank.
Nearly 10 to 7. Much of the UK is watching its water use, or at least being told to, with drought conditions declared and hosepipe bans in force in many areas. Now, one way of saving water would be to use rainwater or other recycled water from domestic appliances for non-drinking purposes, like flushing the loo, for example. Now, you'd need to have a special system that allowed you to separate drinking from non-drinking uses. That is precisely what a development in Cambridge built in 2021 was designed to do, with water savings estimated at 25 litres of water per person per day if the water reuse mechanism had ever been switched on. But it hasn't, to the frustration of campaigners like Lutz Jonan from the UK Water Reuse Association.
The issue currently is, of course, the Water Act, that water companies are not allowed to supply non-potable water. You know, this is where we believe that the law has to change to make way for non-potable water to be applied. Things have moved on, and of course the pressures on water have increased. We need to look into new possibilities, and water reuse is heavily used across the world.
Well, Dr. Marcus Rink is the Chief Inspector of the Drinking Water Inspectorate for England and Wales and joins us. Thank you for joining us this morning, Dr. Rink. The Water Industry Act, what was it created for, and is it preventing this kind of innovation?
Well, I think that's an interesting question and perhaps has a complex answer, because the Water Industry Act was put in place to ensure that water suppliers such as undertakers such as Cambridge Water, for instance, supplies water which is wholesome. That means the water must be fit for use to drink, wash, cook, etc. And so there is a pillar on which the Water Industry Act ensures that water supply by undertakers is safe for customers to use. So
that means that essentially means you can't. It's got to be drinking water quality supplied, and that's the law. And therefore, these water reuse schemes fall on founder on the rocks of this act. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. Because the thing is that there are water reuse schemes in use currently, and in fact, you may recall that the London Olympics in 2012 had quite an extensive reuse system, which we worked in collaboration with the local authorities and the operator to make sure that that was operating in a safe way, and that fell under a different piece of regulation because it was overseen by the local authority, so it was a private supply. Now, that's not the only example. For instance, in our report, which we published this year and commissioned last year, we give a case example of a reuse system near King's Cross, which provides a community supply.
But are you saying, is it the case that we need to try and tinker with the rules a little bit so that public water companies like Cambridge Water or Thames — I had the boss of Thames saying that they're using Evian standard drinking water to cool industrial machinery, which seems crazy.
It is crazy, and that shouldn't be the case. But the thing is that, for instance, if you're thinking about Cambridge Water or Thames Water, these are large companies with subsidiary companies which are not part of the undertaker's business or part of the undertakers, which can are not subject to the Water Industry Act. So, in fact, a big company such as Cambridge Water or Thames Water can provide a subsidiary company which would come under the private water supplies regulations, and therefore that would be under the local authority control. Nevertheless, what I'm not doing is arguing that we shouldn't change the legislation, because I think you would expect and the public would expect supplies for reuse which are safe to use and can continue to be used in a safe way. And, you know, certainly we've looked at recent reuse systems and visited them and made recommendations to ensure that these systems are functional.
Okay.
And continue to be safe to use because, for instance, if you have a system where you're collecting large amounts of water and it's in a container, that will promote bacterial growth. So okay. There is a safety element that sits underneath that.
But you are exploring ways to possibly look at water reuse. Dr. Marcus Ring, Chief Inspector of the Drinking Water Inspectorate. Many thanks.
6:07. The appeal for more military and defensive help for Ukraine has been made once again, this time by Kyiv's Mayor Vitaly Klitschko. He's told the BBC that civilians are at risk from increasing Russian attacks and decreasing protective weapon stocks.
We need ammunition, we need anti-missile systems, we need support from our partners because it's protection for our civilians, protection for it's life of our citizens, life of civilians people.
Well, Dr. Jack Watling joins a senior research fellow for applied military sciences at the Royal United Services Institute. And Jack, good morning. I know you just returned from Kyiv, where there was a significant attack yesterday, 17 people killed. And one of the issues is they do not have the weaponry they need now to intercept Russian missiles.
Well, there's a much bigger issue, which is that neither do we. The global stockpiles of those missiles that can intercept Russian ballistic missiles have largely been expended both in Ukraine and in the Middle East, and production is insufficient to meet demand. And so this is a failure of defense planning. And if we recall the arguments about defense spending that we've been having recently in the UK, this is the consequence of not really investing sufficiently in defense against what is actually quite a predictable threat.
And what does that look like in real terms and what you saw when you were in Kyiv yesterday?
Well, so when I've been in Kyiv previously, you know, you would have these air alerts, but 70% plus of the ballistic missiles and over 90% of the drones were intercepted. And so, you know, there were tragic instances of things being hit, but ultimately people felt that they could move around and live their lives. Whereas what we saw in the last few weeks is that there would be zero intercepts. And so you would just see strike after strike after strike. And while the Russians are trying to target things like Russian, Ukrainian military industrial complexes and so on, they're often hitting blocks of flats. Their intelligence isn't very good. A lot of the weapons go off target. And so people don't know whether they're going to be under the path of one of these. You know, a bookmark got burned down last week. And therefore, you face a choice. Do you take the risk and sleep in your house or do you go into the shelter, which obviously is very difficult to live from? Or are you just going to be up all night, you know? And I think for a lot of people, if they're in parts of the city that get targeted, it becomes a continuous disruption to their ability to live their lives.
And so what are the practical ways of potentially dealing with this? Because, of course, the challenges are countries that still have stocks of Patriot interceptors want and need to keep some for themselves. They are slow to produce. So what might the answer be?
I think the only option that Ukraine really has on this front now, because, as I say, we've failed to increase production in time, is to attack the Russians' ability to manufacture these missiles. So using their own long-range strike to go after Russian military industrial targets is very difficult. But that's probably the only way that you significantly reduce the number of missiles that the Russians have to throw at them. You may be able to expand production of interceptors and so on, but you're talking about improving the situation next year. And Ukraine, in the meantime, is going to take a lot of hits. You know, there's going to be a sustained campaign of strikes going through into the winter.
Dr. Jack Watling from the Royal United Services Institute. Thank you.
December 1988. A plane takes off from Heathrow Airport. 38 minutes later...
I was just driving home, you know. And then this flash of flames.
A Libyan man was convicted of murdering 270 people, but that wasn't the end.
I would imagine Lockerbie has spawned more conspiracy theories than any other human event.
Now, in light of fresh evidence and a new trial, we look again at what happened, leading us to militant groups and global politics. Intrigue Lockerbie. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Thomas Schaffernacker.
Thanks very much, Anna, and a good morning to you. Today we can expect further showers, but there won't be as many showers as there were yesterday. In fact, most of them will affect eastern coastal counties, so from the northeast of England through parts of Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, and perhaps later into East Anglia. There could be one or two showers also developing across parts of Wales, for example, from Pembrokeshire through the Brecon Beacons. But elsewhere today, from morning onwards and through the afternoon and into the evening hours, it is going to be predominantly dry with some sunny spells here and there. Now, the winds are coming in from the north and it is a relatively cool source, so temperatures aren't spectacularly high. Well, they have been very high for months, but I think 22, 23 Celsius will feel very fresh in the south of the country, and highs no higher than 17 Celsius in places like Belfast, Glasgow and also Edinburgh. Now, tonight we'll have one or two showers elsewhere, but predominantly clear spells. The night will be quite fresh. Early in the morning in some rural spots of northern Britain, temperatures could be 2 or 3 degrees, but that's mostly out of town. For most of us, it'll be closer to 8. And then tomorrow and through the weekend, we have high pressure building with sunshine.
Thanks, Thomas. You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Simon Jack in London.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday the 21st of August. The headlines this morning: the Met Office says the developing El Niño weather event is set to be the strongest in living memory, making it very likely that next year will break global temperature records. Reports say the Duchess of Sussex will return to acting after being offered a role based in the UK. And Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been returned to prison after a court-ordered visit to hospital.
Also in the programme, something spooked the bond markets. What's going on and what does it mean for us? And it's one of the most infamous goals in the history of football.
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee. And the goal is given. A use of the hand that England are complaining about.
40 years on from Diego Maradona's Hand of God goal against England at the 1986 World Cup, the ball from that match is up for sale. But why are we still so fascinated by that moment? The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The Met Office is warning that a developing El Niño weather system is set to become the strongest in living memory, possibly since the 19th century. Forecasters say that combined with climate change, the phenomenon could result in next year being the hottest in recorded history. El Niño is a recurring climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which sees unusually warm waters boost the risk of extreme weather around the world. More detail from our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Met Office is warning sea temperatures in the central tropical Pacific could rise more than 3 degrees above normal in the coming months. That is far beyond the range of a typical El Niño. That matters because El Niño can shift weather patterns across the globe. Central America, tropical South America and parts of Australia are among the regions at increased risk of drought. In the Atlantic, El Niño tends to suppress hurricanes. The Met Office says the event could increase the chances of wetter, stormier conditions across northwest Europe, including the UK, this autumn and early winter. It is also likely to push up global temperatures, which is why the Met Office said today that 2027 was very likely to overtake 2024 as the warmest year on record.
The Panama Canal Authority has announced restrictions on marine traffic because of drought conditions fuelled by El Niño. The waterway links the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans and handles 5% of global maritime trade. David Bamford reports.
The Panama Canal Authority needs huge amounts of fresh water to raise and lower ships through its locks. Ships are currently waiting about 10 days to pass through the canal, which links the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. Because of the El Niño effect, there's been insufficient rain to replenish the water supply, so the authority says it's cutting the number of daily transit slots, and shipping companies are being told to reduce vessel hold depths by carrying less cargo.
The Home Office says French police officers have stopped 185 small boats from crossing the Channel in the first 3 months of a new deal with Paris. Citing data from the authorities in France, the government says new tactics, including the deployment of a 50-strong riot squad, prevented more than 4,300 migrants from making the journey. Despite the increased enforcement activity, more than 8,000 people came to Britain on small boats over the same period. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
The government signed a new deal with France in April, paying more than £600 million for tougher policing on the other side of the Channel. Officials say more boat equipment is now being seized on the way to the coast. More dinghies are being intercepted and punctured on the beaches. And for the first time, they're being stopped at sea, regarded as a safety risk in the past. Three boats were prevented from entering British waters in the last 2 weeks, having left the French coast. 61% of crossing attempts have been intercepted, but that's an increase of only 5% compared with the same period last year. The Conservatives said they would refuse asylum claims to small boat migrants, a policy which would mean leaving the European Convention on Human Rights.
Sources close to the Sussex family have not denied reports that Meghan has been offered an acting role in the UK. No details have been confirmed. Harry and Meghan are set to move into a private residence away from London within days. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The Duchess of Sussex put her acting career on hold after her marriage to Prince Harry. But reports in Australian media say she is going back to acting with a role in a UK-based entertainment project. And this is one of the reasons why the Sussex family is leaving America. Harry and Meghan's representatives are not denying the story, but aren't giving any details at this stage. As an actress, she was best known for her part in the US legal drama Suits, where she played Rachel Zane, a lawyer, for 7 seasons. A return to acting could be lucrative for Meghan. Interest will be high in whatever she does, as the UK return of the Sussexes continues to grab attention.
The Duke of Sussex and other high-profile claimants who lost their High Court privacy case against the publisher of the Daily Mail are expected to find out more about how much they'll have to pay for their failed legal battle this afternoon. The group, which includes Sir Elton John and Elizabeth Hurley, unsuccessfully sued Associated Newspapers Limited over claims of unlawful information gathering. Our correspondent Helena Wilkinson reports.
This afternoon, a High Court judge is expected to rule on an initial payment to Associated Newspapers Limited for its costs. A&L had asked for around £10 million. Prince Harry and the others involved are also expected to find out if A&L will be able to claim further costs on an indemnity basis, which would result in a more favourable financial payout for the company. The High Court heard in July the case had already cost the Daily Mail's publisher almost £34.5 million. The claimants are insured for just over £16 million.
Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been returned to prison after receiving a health check at a hospital in Islamabad. He's 3 years into a jail term for corruption. His supporters say the prosecution was political and his health is deteriorating. But Pakistan's information minister said a team of doctors had declared him medically fit. From Islamabad, here's our Pakistan correspondent Caroline Davis.
Imran Khan's hospital visit was the result of the most significant relief he's been given by the courts since his imprisonment more than 3 years ago on charges he says are politically motivated. The judges made their decision after considering a medical report that highlighted his fluctuating blood pressure, anxiety and palpitations. The court directed Mr. Khan to be taken to the private Shifa International Hospital. Last night it was sealed off, and while Mr. Khan's PTI party confirmed his arrival, the authorities didn't. This morning, Pakistan's information minister has said that instead he was taken to a state-run hospital because of the security situation. The minister also said that Imran Khan had been transferred back to prison after being declared medically fit by a team of doctors. The sudden court order has led to speculation that there are political manoeuvres behind the scenes between the former prime minister's PTI party and Pakistan's powerful military and intelligence services. That is not something either side has commented on.
The High Court in Hong Kong has found two pro-democracy activists who organised annual vigils marking the Tiananmen Square massacre in Beijing guilty of incitement of subversion. Chow Hung Tung and Lee Chuk Yan face up to 10 years in prison. The campaign group Human Rights Watch said they were being punished for reminding the Chinese government of its atrocities. Figures just released by the Office for National Statistics show that government borrowing was £1.8 billion in July, two-thirds higher than the same month last year. The figure was £2.3 billion above the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast. A British woman who's believed to be the world's oldest living person is celebrating her 117th birthday. Ethel Caterham, who lives in Lightwater in Surrey, will spend the day with her family and friends, as Rebecca Drought reports.
Ethel Caterham was born just days before workers started pouring concrete for the Panama Canal. In 1909, the aeroplane altitude record stood at just 300 metres. Mrs. Caterham, who's born in Hampshire 5 years before the start of the First World War, says she's had a year of firsts, despite living through a century of monumental technological, political and social change. She held hands with the king when he visited her in September and stroked a llama. She said she was looking forward to what the next year might bring.
Rebecca Drought reporting.
Thank you very much, Caroline. 9 minutes past seven. Now, by any measure, 2026 has been an extraordinary one weather-wise. A wave of heat waves, new record temperatures, much of the UK in drought. Climate change is already bringing us summers with scorching temperatures. But the likelihood of extreme weather is set to be exacerbated by something else, El Niño. The climate pattern defined by the warming of sea surface temperatures in the Pacific, and this is coming the year the phenomenon is more extreme than for decades, maybe more than a century, in fact, and that's according to the Met Office. And its head of long-range forecasting is Professor Adam Scaife. And that top head of long-range forecasting sounds like a risky job to Professor Scaife, I must say. But tell us how unusual, how extreme the phenomenon we're beginning to witness is.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You're right. This event, I have not seen an event like this developing in our forecasts before. And assuming the forecasts are correct and many other centres are giving the same signals, then we're expecting the biggest El Niño for over a century, peaking at something over 3 degrees. That is unheard of in modern climate records.
That's pushing the temperature in the Pacific up by 3 degrees. And what?
That's right.
And what are the implications and consequences of that?
So these things are quite long-lived. El Niño comes and goes every few years. But when it's arriving like now, we can already see it building. It's up to nearly 2 degrees already. It'll carry on for months, peaking around November, December. And the impacts are worldwide. So they're particularly strong throughout the tropics, where we expect really severe droughts in places like South America and the West Pacific. And then there are wave-like disturbances that come out from the tropics and affect places like the UK. So we already see signals for increased rainfall and storminess in the autumn here in the UK around November time.
And I'm just trying to get the cause and effect here. Does El Niño cause this? Or, for example, is it connected to the fact that we've had very hot temperatures already in Northern Europe this year? Or are those two things completely mutually exclusive or not affecting each other?
In this case, the El Niño causes these effects. With climate change, it's very difficult to create cause and effect when you have a particularly extreme weather pattern. But we know these patterns from long series of historical observations and our latest computer simulations. So we can be very confident that it's the El Niño in the Pacific that is driving the drought that we see coming in South America over the Amazon region, that is driving these patterns that appear across the Atlantic in the coming months and likely give wetter and stormier Northwest Europe.
Okay. And is it cyclical, though? So, for example, it doesn't happen every year, El Niño, correct?
That's right.
And does that mean that we could have a particularly severe one this year and then not see it again for another 4 or 5?
That's absolutely right. It's not really cyclical in the sense that it repeats after a certain number of years. It's not that regular. What happens is the underlying interactions between the atmosphere and the ocean in the Pacific create a kind of feedback loop. So any small perturbation in the tropics can then grow. And sometimes, if it's strong enough, it can grow into the El Niño like we're seeing this year. But there isn't a regular pattern. It's not every 5 years or so. It's not that you will be able to predict perfectly. What happens is you get oscillations between El Niño like this year, La Nina, the cold phase, in alternate years, but it's not perfectly regular. Okay. We need forecasts to be able to see when it's coming.
And we were just hearing in the headlines that what's going on in the Panama Canal. They're saying not enough water on the Pacific side to put enough water in to raise the ships as they're going through the canal. And you're saying we can expect droughts in South America, which are incredibly important food sources. This sounds quite a dire warning or dire prognosis for you know, not just the weather, but world trade, world food production.
Mm-hmm. There are well-known impacts on other systems, including food and food security. Actually, Central America and northern parts of South America are really highlighted as drought regions in our latest forecasts. And that's for the coming months. These are not short-term weather forecasts. We're talking about really long-term, persistent conditions here from El Nino.
And being slightly parochial, bottom line for the UK is expect a stormy and wet winter.
It's really autumn that we're seeing the big signal for stormy and wet. Okay. So October, November, maybe December. We'll look at later winter when we get closer, I think.
Okay. All right. Don't forecast that long range ahead. Ahead of long range forecasting there, Professor Adam Scaife. Thank you very much indeed.
14 minutes past seven now. How to keep the Duke and Duchess of Sussex safe when they return to the UK is one of the big questions this morning after the couple's plans were revealed yesterday. Andy Burnham says it's a private matter for Harry and Meghan to consider. Their security detail here is decided on by a specialist committee who downgraded their allowance when they left the country for America in 2020. And you might remember that Prince Harry has since fought a court battle to try and get some of it reinstated. Well, Di Davies is a former head of Royal Protection, former divisional commander in the Metropolitan Police. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning to you.
How does protecting royals here in the UK differ from protecting other non-royal people who might be at risk and need security?
Well, as you rightly said, each case is judged on its merits. The RAVAC, who are the committee that decide this, have representatives from the palace itself, from the Home Office, from the Metropolitan Police, and I'm sure input from the intelligence services. So each case is considered carefully, and as a consequence, the appropriate level is then applied to the individual in question. That's how it has been done. It wasn't done that way when I was in command, but certainly that's the way it's done now. And I'm told it's a careful, measured system, and one has to put some reliance that this is arguably the best way to assess a threat, which you can never be 100% sure on any related security, because there's no such thing.
Is it likely to be looked at once again and reassessed by that committee if the family is living here in the UK as opposed to when they are just visiting the country?
Well, I think it's changed. The whole structure now has changed, and there's a different emphasis because he is now at 100% about turn by saying that he clearly feels it is safe for him to bring his family here. And that's 100% change, really, from a few months ago. And clearly, as you already stated, there was a court case. He was coming in normally on his own. And that, given that he was giving 28 days notice, was then assessed appropriately, depending on what he was doing. Now it's changed the whole dynamics, I think, and I suspect, and it's only a suspicion on my part, that they will review once again if Harry brings his family, lives in this country, and intends to remain here. The big question for me is, one, what the motive is, two, what are they going to do all day, and three, and like a bit like Edward VIII, when he was told by his brother, you're no longer welcome in this country, I do wonder what on earth is going to go on, and are they going to set up a semi-court themselves? So many questions and many answers at the moment.
Yes, various questions which people are seeking answers to. Just as a final thought, Di, when protection is being given to people who are potentially at threat, of course, there are various people in the UK who are not of royal birth, who pay for private security as opposed to having public taxpayer-funded security. Is there any difference in the level of security? Are there things that you can do if you are the police, for example, that you can't do if you're private security?
Well, yes, there's a huge range of things that the police, in conjunction with the intelligence, can do and get that intelligence far quicker and more succinctly, and then apply it to the operational requirement. But, you know, the key thing, and what worries me about this whole thing, is in any kind of security aspect, you need planning. And it isn't an overnight thing. And what worries me is how much planning and how much thought has gone into this, whether it's private security, which he already has, or whether in some way or other he persuades somebody that you and I should pay for it. I've been opposed to that.
Yeah, various things to change to take into account.
I would seek that he pays for it himself, because it's enormously expensive, particularly if you're moving into a premises which is not security matched, it's not security prepared. And then you have all the other aspects of children going to school, the two of them now, two adults and two children, and their contingents, the people with them. It's a huge aspect which needs proper structure and planning. And I can't imagine so far a great deal of that has gone in.
Di Davies, former head of Royal Protection, former divisional commander in the Metropolitan Police. Thank you.
Very nearly 20 past seven. Consumer confidence is at a two-year high, according to new figures. Will Bain is back with more. Hi, Will.
There's a glimmer, potentially, of light, Simon, amongst a lot of the kind of economic headwinds, as people like to say to people like me and you. Yes, morning. Consumers supposedly feeling more confident in their personal finances, making major purchases, and in their economic outlook for the next 12 months. So says the market research company GFK and its long-running Consumer Confidence Index. This morning comes alongside some better news as well from the ONS around retail sales, up 1.1% in the 3 months to July compared to the 3 months to April earlier on this year. Andrew Murphy is the chief executive at The Entertainer, more than 160 stores across the UK. Morning, Andrew.
Good morning.
That confidence then being reflected?
Yeah, I'd say so. We've had a good year, to be honest, and it has stayed strong across the summer. The good weather helps people's mood generally. And I think there's been plenty of motivation for people to get out and spend, with the prolonged good weather, meaning that there's some predictability and people don't mind making an investment to have their family enjoy that summer weather.
Well, you touched on a bit of it there. Predictability. What, predictability in the weather? Predictability in policy? What is it that's kind of driven a bit of that, do you think?
Well, I think predictability in the weather in the main, and I think sporting events kind of help. There be a bit of energy around, you know, help people come into town centres and enjoy what they've got to offer. Policy wise, look, it's too soon to say if anything is meaningfully going to change, but I'd say that businesses certainly welcome the fact that the slightly kind of studied hopelessness that we've been putting up with for the last couple of years from the government, that there does at least seem to have been a change in tone. And things sound a little bit more front-footed.
Looking ahead then, Neil Bellamy himself from GFK, their head of consumer insights, saying many challenges ahead. What are some of those and how do you navigate them?
Well, obviously, energy prices are probably going to be on an upward curve again. And although there's a bit of a lag there in how that comes through, that is expected. People still rolling off lower interest rate mortgages onto higher ones. And I don't think anybody expects the major economic fundamentals that have been dragging on the country to transform anytime soon. And for businesses, the cost burden, while sales obviously help, the cost burden is at an all-time high. And we're all really hoping that the new Prime Minister does something about that in the budget in the autumn.
Yeah, interesting. Going to be plenty of challenge ahead, it sounds there. Andrew Murphy, the Chief Exec of The Entertainer, thanks so much for your time. Should say as well, Simon, we heard it in the headlines, didn't we? But we, alongside those retail sales from the ONS, we also got figures about public debt, public borrowing, £1.8 billion in July 2026. Was the amount that the government borrowed. This was 0.7 billion more than in July 2025, and compared to the OBR forecast, 2.3 billion above that as well.
Okay, we're going to be talking a little bit to Charlie Bean, former Deputy Governor of Bank of England, about borrowing costs both here and in the US, because the bond markets are spooked at the moment. But Will Bain, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you both. 22 minutes past seven now. Today is the first National Day for Victims and Survivors of Terrorism. And to coincide with it, a new report is warning that survivors of attacks don't always get the support that they need afterwards. The organisers are hoping that the event will draw attention to that by really amplifying stories that in the intervening years can sometimes be forgotten. Well, Jo Berry is with us. Her father, Sir Anthony Berry, the MP for Enfield Southgate, died when an IRA bomb exploded at the Conservative Party conference at the Grand Hotel in Brighton in 1984. She is also co-author of that Survivors Against Terror report. And Paul Price sustained life-changing injuries and lost his partner, Elaine, at the Manchester Arena terror attack in 2017. He has also contributed to that report. Jo, Paul, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Paul, first of all, if you would, we said there that part of today is to really talk about these stories and reflect on them and remind people about them. So if you wouldn't mind sharing yours with us again, it's an event which is still fresh in the memory for many people and, of course, for you as well.
Yeah. So I, myself and my partner, had taken my daughter and a friend to the Ariana Grande concert. We dropped them off. They were only 13 at the time. It was their first concert on their own. Obviously, they were very excited. We saw them safely into the arena. Then Elaine and I went into Manchester for a meal. We were in the process of buying our forever home at the time. So we were very excited about that. Talk was all around that. And then we made our way back to the arena. We're waiting in the city room, like the foyer of the arena, like many other mums and dads, waiting for the concert to end. And then we all know what happened.
Yeah. And your life since then, how much do you feel that you have had? I'm sure there's so much empathy from people and sympathy and people wanting to support you. But to what extent do you not have things that you need that would be really helpful to you after something like this?
Well, as you can imagine, after something like this, you know, losing the love of my life, losing the person I was, losing the career I had. I came out of hospital 9 months later, totally lost, directionless, and, you know, I thought life was over for me. All the time I was in hospital, I was told, don't worry about a thing, Paul, you'll be looked after when you get out. There'll be loads of support, there'll be loads of help, just concentrating on your rehab. And that's what I did. And I came out of hospital 9 months later to nothing. I thought, well, I remember saying to myself, Paul, you've been in hospital too long and they've forgotten about you. And they had. I couldn't live on my own at the time. I was living with my parents who were in no position really to look after me. I went from a fully equipped rehab ward to my parents' home with a physio coming out once a week looking for things in the house to aid with my recovery. There was no one knocking on my door saying, right, this has happened to you, Paul. You know, that life is over now, but, you know, you've still got a life. As far as I was concerned, my life was over and, you know, I needed help. I was navigating so many things, you know, life-changing injuries, the loss of Elaine. I wasn't in a position to start, you know, creating a new life for myself. And I was left alone for such a long time.
And Joe, the report that you and others have put together that Paul, as we were saying, has contributed to, yes. Do you think that's something that is shared, that assumption that for people like Paul who've been involved in such a high-profile event, that the things that they need will be there and therefore people just aren't looking as closely, aren't focusing as much as they need to check that, really?
Definitely, definitely. Paul's story is one of many of saying having to fight for compensation, which means they can change their house so they can actually live in it. Just basic human rights has not been there. And since we've been campaigning, we have had some success. And I first want to say that today is an extraordinary day. We're going to meet in London for the first time. It feels like we matter and that people care about us. And it's going to be very moving and just very amazing. And we've also got an incredible way of getting mental health now. I was shocked when I discovered that people weren't getting any mental health support. Back in 1984, there was no support, but things didn't change. And now we have this hub, totally aligned for us, the terrorism support hub, where there will be a way of people getting mental health, even those who have had to wait 20 years, 30 years. So that's amazing. But there are still areas which we're having to work on. And one of them is definitely compensation. There's some countries in Europe where it's just automatic, there's a way through. Also asking for like immediate financial assistance because people need that straight away. And in France, people just get a lump sum if they were there. And that just immediately takes care of some of the physical problems. When we're affected by terrorism, it's so huge, the trauma on many, many levels. And people deserve to get the ongoing support. And now we have some progress, but we're not going to forget the areas which we still need to work on.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to your own experience, Joe, that as we said, this happened in 1984 when you lost your dad, but that you're still, it is still clearly such a huge part of your life that you want to be involved in it now and try and push for that change.
I care too much. You know, I know what the journey's like. It's a very lonely, it can be so lonely. You know, it took me like 12 years before I even met anyone who'd been affected by terrorism apart from my family. And there's something about meeting other people who understand. So people deserve better. They're promised so, so much, and then it just doesn't happen. And I've heard too many stories of people from Manchester Arena, even from 7/7. I did a report on 20 years on, and the kind of support they got was not adequate. So now we have people who are absolutely equipped to understand what it means to give trauma support. And I think we are changing things. It's been slow. But I'm very grateful for those that have cared enough to put the policies in place to make it happen. And today, you know, it is a success, but it's also, and there is more we need to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's a clear message from you both. And I thank you both for speaking to us this morning, Joe Berry and Paul Price. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
29 minutes past seven. The time for some sport with Mike Williams. Mike.
Hello again, Simon. England will resume day three of the first test with Pakistan today on 366 for eight. That is a first innings lead of 195. You'll be able to follow all the action from Headingley with Test Match Special over on BBC Sounds from 10:25. We now, though, are going to talk football because it is 89 days since Arsenal lifted the Premier League trophy and were officially crowned champions of England for the first time in 22 years. Well, tonight they begin the defence of their title as the 2026-27 Premier League season gets underway. Arsenal host newly promoted Coventry City at the Emirates in the Friday night curtain raiser to the new season. And we can have a quick chat with the BBC's chief football writer, Phil McNulty, who joins us. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Mike.
Most people, from what I've seen, seem to be tipping Arsenal as favourites to win the Premier League again this season and defend their title. Do you go along with that?
I think I do, Mike, to be honest with you. I think they finally crossed the psychological barrier of winning that first Premier League title for 22 years. They looked pretty close to complete last season doing that, but they've added real quality in the summer as well. They brought in Bruno Guimaraes from Newcastle United. Christos Solis looked a bargain at £34 million in the Community Shield. And of course, they're now adding Ezri Konsa from Aston Villa to add strength in defence as well. So yes, going along with what we saw when they pretty much dismantled Manchester City in the Community Shield and what we already know about them as champions and what they've added to the squad, I think they're rightly regarded as favourites to retain their title this season.
Who will be their main challengers this season, do you predict?
I think the threat will come from the usual areas, and even though Manchester City were poor last week, I think they will be challenging Arsenal again this season. There will undoubtedly be a period of transition under Enzo Maresca when someone as sort of defining as Pep Guardiola leaves a club, and they've also lost big players and personalities such as Rodri, John Stones and Bernardo Silva. But I think any side with Erling Haaland at its spearhead will always be challenging for honours, so I think they'll be in there. Liverpool as well, I think, will improve. Whether they improve enough to mount a title challenge, I'm not quite sure, but certainly I think Arsenal favourites, but Manchester City and Liverpool, I think, will challenge them, particularly Manchester City, season, even though they made that poor start in the Community Shield last week, which, for context, is only a pre-season friendly.
We shall see. Plenty of twists and turns, I predict, in this Premier League season over the next 10 months or so. Enjoy it, and we'll speak to you throughout it, I'm sure. BBC's chief football writer, Phil McNulty, there, by the way. Coventry City fans saying, why aren't you talking about Coventry? Do not worry. The club's owner and chairman, Doug King, will be joining us live in the studio in the next hour of the programme. And by the way, the last time Coventry opened their Premier League campaign at Arsenal, this happened.
Quinn against Seaman. 1-0! Coventry win the ball easily in midfield. Lovely back heel for Quinn. And Quinn makes it 2-0! Undlove again picks it up on the edge of his own area. Puts it outside to Mickey Quinn. He's got Williams in the middle. He doesn't need him! He's made it 3! A hat-trick for Mickey Quinn!
Yes, one of the great hat-tricks of the early Premier League years there. Mickey Quinn scoring his famous hat-trick for Coventry at Highbury back in 1993 in a 3-0 victory. I think Coventry would probably take that tonight, a 3-0 win against the champions at Arsenal. We shall see.
I think they probably would. Thank you, Mike. Now, a new series of The Reunion starts this Sunday on Radio 4.
Explore moments of modern history with me, Kirsty Wark. All I could think of is that I hadn't been sacked, so I must be doing something all right. Meet the people who brought Casualty to our screens 40 years ago. Revisit two landmark Scottish films from the 1980s.
I'm so jealous I wasn't in Local Hero.
And first, relive the Isle of Wight Festival, one of the biggest music events of the 20th century.
Well, it looked like a medieval encampment on the eve of a great battle, and it was incredibly spectacular.
That's The Reunion on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starting on Sunday morning at 10.
You're listening today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and at 26 minutes to 8, Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The Met Office is warning that 2027 is very likely to be the hottest year on record because of the impact of a developing El Niño weather system, which the forecaster expects to become the strongest in living memory. The naturally occurring climate phenomenon affects weather across the world and could lead to wetter and stormier conditions in the UK this autumn and early winter. The Panama Canal Authority has announced new measures to manage the transit of vehicles as drought caused by El Niño threatens the critical waterway. It's cutting the number of daily transit slots, and shipping companies are being told to reduce the depths of vessels by carrying less cargo. Figures released by the Office for National Statistics show that government borrowing was £1.8 billion in July, two-thirds higher than the same month last year. The figure was £2.3 billion above the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast. The Home Office says a deal with Paris to intercept small boats crossing the Channel has hit the ground running in the 3 months since it was signed in the spring. Officials say 185 crossings have been prevented over 3 months. More than 8,000 small migrants, boat migrants, did arrive in the period. 250 crossed on Monday this week. Reports in Australian media say the Duchess of Sussex is returning to acting and has secured a role in the UK ahead of the Sussex family's move back to England in a few weeks. Meghan's team are not denying the claims. Prince Harry, Sir Elton John and Elizabeth Hurley are among the high-profile claimants who are set to find out how much they'll be charged for their failed legal battle to sue the publisher of the Daily Mail. The High Court heard in July that costs incurred by Associated Newspapers Limited had already reached almost £34.5 million.
Caroline, thank you. As you were hearing just then, the government had to borrow £1.8 billion in July, and that happens when governments spend more than they collect in tax. They need to borrow the difference, and they do that by issuing bonds. These are IOUs to investors like pension funds and others, and they're considered low risk because countries can tax their citizens to raise the money to pay them back. But there have been some real jitters in the bond markets this week, with investors' appetite for them cooling, pushing up the cost of borrowing for governments around the world, leading the US Treasury, the biggest borrower of them all, to try and intervene by buying up some of the long-dated bonds, some of the longer-term loans, in order to bolster some confidence. And it has not worked, it seems. Well, Professor Sir Charlie Bean is Professor of Economics at the LSE, former Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, and joins us now. Morning, Charlie.
Morning.
Now, the thing is that people are getting what is should be the most boring and safest of investments. Investors are beginning to turn their nose at them. Why, and what does it mean?
Well, there's a number of factors going on here, and I think it is important, as your introduction made clear, this is not a UK-specific issue that's going on. It's a more global thing where investors are looking at governments really across the developed world that are running large debt and deficits, and particularly the US now is in the crosshairs. Traditionally, we thought of US treasuries, that's US government bonds, as being, you know, the super safe asset of the global financial system. But the US government is planning to run deficits for as far as the eye can see, with the debt to GDP ratio continuing to rise.
Yeah, which is it's well over 100% already, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's about 120%, yeah. I think.
40 trillion.
Which is considerably more than over here. Yeah. And people are starting to get somewhat nervous about that. In addition, it's worth remembering that there's a lot of competition coming not only from other governments that are borrowing, but also from the private sector. So there is an investment boom going on in the US, but it's very much driven by investment in data centers, by the so-called hyperscalers. And a lot of this investment is financed by borrowing. Mm-hmm. And these are huge numbers involved. So there's a lot of competition in the bond markets for a limited supply of funds.
Okay, so you've basically got the Amazons and the Googles and the other and the whole AI ecosystem on a borrowing binge, and so governments having to compete against that to for investors. At what point? Let's look at the US. You say 120-something% of debt to GDP, much higher than in the UK. Is there a moment at which the international community stops lending to Uncle Sam? At what point does this become an issue? Because the Treasury is, in many ways, is the benchmark asset around the world. If that is seen as risky, that can unsettle the whole thing, can't it?
Well, it will be extremely scary if we get to that point, because US Treasuries are this fundamental safe asset, and it's the key collateral that is offered up for people to borrow against, for financial institutions and so forth. So if there is a general run from US Treasuries, it would cause considerable turmoil in financial markets. Now, you asked the question about, you know, is there a point that where this will happen? Well, yeah, there probably is a point, but unfortunately, we don't know where it is. And it's not, it's not as if there's a fixed number that we could say, you know, if it gets to 150%, you know, disaster will happen. Mm. But we're okay if we stay at 145.
Yeah.
All the lesson from financial crises, public debt crises that we've seen in other countries is that often countries can keep on borrowing for quite a long time. Then all of a sudden, something happens. It may be political. Not necessarily an economic event, but something happens to punch a confidence in the government's willingness or ability to meet its obligations.
Yeah.
And of course, the longer that a government may give the impression that it's blasé about things, the more risk that will happen.
Well, that's the interesting thing. So there's two ways out of this, presumably. Either President Trump can change course on his tax-cutting agenda and therefore try and make, if you like, the books balance. I mean, some people don't like that expression, but you know what I mean, to get the deficit down. Or, as we know from the past, the central bank can step in and start buying up some of these bonds to reduce their thing. We've seen that happen before. What are the likelihood of that, do you think?
Well, I think that central banks would step in the short term if there's turmoil in financial markets, because their obligation is to maintain financial stability, so that if there's a loss of confidence in what are key collateral assets in the financial system, a central bank will step in as a buyer of last resort, essentially in the way, say, the Bank of England did during the aftermath of the Truss Kwarteng budget back in 2022. But what it wouldn't want to do is be standing there as a long-term buyer, as basically replacing the private market.
Right.
That's basically what economists refer to as monetary finance.
Right.
And in the end, is likely to be associated with a substantial increase in the money supply and a substantial increase in inflation. And that's how things really unravel.
That's what we've done. The last thing
they did in Argentina.
Charlie Bean, Professor Sir Charlie Bean, we're going to have to leave it there. Many thanks for that. On the jitters affecting the bond market, which of course have implications for things like mortgage rates, both in the US and in the UK.
It's 18 minutes to 8 now.
Now, this is one of the most famous moments in the history of football.
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee. And the goal is given. A use of the hand that England are complaining about.
Well, the ball that the hand of God flicked past Peter Shilton then was later dribbled past some lurching English defenders as the Argentinian crushed England's hopes and scored what many consider the greatest goal in World Cup history. And that ball is up for sale this weekend in the US with an estimate of $10 million, £7 million. Maradona, of course, died in 2020. Guillaume Balaguer, a football journalist and biographer of Diego Maradona. And I'm sure it's no surprise to you, Guillaume, that the ball that scored one of the greatest goals and one of the most controversial is so sought after.
Well, yes, Simon, but they tried to sell it before, and even though somebody tried to pay £2.5 million, it did not sell. This was about 6 years ago, because the price that they wanted for is closer to what you say, to the 10 million. So it would be extraordinary if that happens. It's a deflated ball. It doesn't even look a proper ball. But of course, it's one iconic one for somebody that is remembered in the Anglo-Saxon world as a genius and as a cheat.
Yeah. That's the thing about Maradona, isn't he? He's a sublime footballer, gifted. He's also a villain. He's an athlete. He's a drug addict. He's got so many different faces.
Yes, and again, you have to separate how he's perceived in the Anglo-Saxon world and in the Latin world. In the Anglo-Saxon world, because you did not hear him talk, he had an interview with Gary Lineker and the BBC. I've got in my YouTube channel a chat that I had of an hour, subtitle, that is the Asif Kapadia documentary, a couple of books. But generally, it's what you see, what people have seen, is a genius, as you said, and who also was a cheat, who had iconic moments like that warm-up, Duopo's Life is Life in the semi-finals of the UEFA Cup just before playing against Bayern Munich, where he was dancing instead of warming up. Things that you see is remembered for. In the Latin world, he's so much more. He's seen basically as somebody that changed football.
Mm. I think, if you go to Argentina, I've been to visit, you almost see religious iconography of Maradona in some places you go to.
Yeah, for two reasons. One, because they see him as somebody that changed football. He was the first one to have a press officer, the first one to have a physio, a personal physio, the first one to have or to create a trade union for players, the first one to challenge FIFA and UEFA and saying that they were corrupt, the first one to have a go at the Pope, because he thought he could. But also in Argentina, they embrace very quickly somebody that actually challenges or sees himself as one of the best in the world, because they themselves feel that they haven't been allowed to be one of the best in the world. But once somebody represents them that way, straight away, he goes up into the Olympus. But again, because he won, and he won a World Cup with Argentina, that gives him, as you said, the religious status, really.
Yeah, well, hero or villain, he is a legend. And the ball that he slotted past some very ordinary-looking English defenders that day and flicked one past Peter Shilton on sale this weekend for an estimated price of £7 million. Guillaume Balaguer, thank you.
It's 14 minutes to 8 now. It's time for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is Dr. Krish Kandia, theologian and founder of the Sanctuary Foundation Refugee Charity.
Good morning. I spare a thought for all those who feel it's been non-stop football recently. For months, it's been almost impossible to escape the world's most watched sport. In May, the Premier League run-in drew huge audiences. In June, the Lionesses qualified for the Women's World Cup. Into July, the Men's World Cup dominated our screens. Today, it starts again as the English Premier League whirs back into action. Even non-football fans have been pulled into the drama. Donald Trump caused shock, lobbying FIFA to lift a suspended American player's ban mid-tournament. There was further outrage when Gianni Infantino proposed selling a fifth of FIFA's commercial rights to private investors. With such forces at play, football seems far removed from the experience of one Algerian goalkeeper in 1957. All that I know most surely about morality and obligations I owe to football. That goalkeeper, better remembered as French existentialist philosopher Albert Camus, might not recognise the sport today. Perhaps even he would be tempted to ask, has the beautiful game lost its soul? It's a fair question, considering a third of the clubs that have ever played in the Premier League grew out of churches. Everton started as a Methodist church team. Tottenham Hotspur was founded by a Sunday school teacher. Manchester City began life as West Gorton FC, created in the 1880s by a vicar and his daughter to help young men find connection away from gang violence. Some of that vision remains. Last year, Manchester City's community charity delivered around £40 million worth of public benefit. Football still plays a transformative role in our communities, even though at the highest levels, the sport's moral purpose risks being subsumed by raw capitalism. Reconnection with its faith roots could help make that moral vision central again. After England's astonishing 6-4 World Cup win over France, seven players from both sides locked arms in an on-pitch prayer huddle. Crystal Palace's dressing room is reportedly one of the league's most prayerful. Arsenal's so-called Bible bros, Saka, Eze, Timber, Jesus and Madueke, and Lioness Michelle Adjemang are some of our best players trying to live out their faith publicly under intense pressure. Football and faith were never strangers. They just stopped talking for a while. If the faith of those on the field could inspire faith in the boardroom too, perhaps we can restore the vision that originally inspired our football clubs.
That was Thought for the Day with Dr. Chris Candia, theologian and founder of the Sanctuary Foundation Refugee Charity.
It is 11 minutes to 8 now. The family of a 13-year-old girl who took her own life weeks after her birthday say that her social media accounts had been pushing her a number of harmful and disturbing videos that normalised and promoted suicide. Blake Gallier from Northfleet in Kent had appeared totally fine before taking her own life. Now her parents are backing plans to ban under-16s from using social media, and they want other families as well to be more aware of the hidden dangers. Well, I've been speaking to Blake's mum, Gemma Best, who told me what her daughter was like.
She was a normal, what I class as a normal teenager. She was full of life. She was bubbly, bright, outgoing. She had a wide circle of friends. She was extremely popular and was just what I thought like any normal teenager. The evening before that I found Blake, I was on my way home from work, got home, she seemed absolutely fine, gave her a cuddle, asked how school had been. She said fine, like she normally did, absolutely fine. We had dinner, you know, had a chat as we normally did, talked about Christmas because it was October. She told me about everything that she wanted for Christmas, which was multiple things, mainly skincare. And then in the morning, I went to wake her up for school. And I couldn't get into her bedroom to start off with and couldn't quite work out what was happening. And then, you know, I found that she'd taken her own life. So, yeah. Yeah.
I think any parent listening to what you describe there, Gemma, will just be struck by the absolute normality of it all.
Yeah.
It sounds like any of us at home on any day, any evening. And that's one of the reasons that I know that you're so keen to talk about this. There wasn't anything, was there, that,
no,
that pointed
there wasn't.
Towards her having problems or what she'd been looking at online?
No, absolutely. I mean, I've got a 19-year-old and she's always struggled with her mental health. So as a parent, I kind of thought that I was very aware of the signs of mental health. Blake did not display any signs whatsoever. She was outgoing. She went out with her friends. She didn't stay in her bedroom for hours on end. you know, she was constantly out with her friends. You know, we went on family holidays, we went to the theme park, you know, we did so much as a family together. You know, we visited friends regularly. And yeah, she there was no signs. There was absolutely no signs. She had a phone, which, you know, she was 13 years old and all of her friends had a phone. Her dad was very against her having a phone, I should say, and he didn't actually allow her to have it when it was in the presence of him. But, you know, I didn't obviously think there was a risk to it. I, you know, they all had them.
The way you're talking, it, again, normal. And you did all of the things you talk about, not leaving her in the room on her own. You know,
yeah.
Having a phone is just so common at that age now, isn't it? And it was
absolutely.
I think... At a much later point that you found out what she was looking at online and specifically these videos about suicide. It wasn't straight away that you discovered that, was it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, obviously, after we lost Blake, the police took her phone and went through it. And that's where we discovered that she'd been looking at these images and had been reposting. She had a private account that none of us were aware of. You know, and to be fair, it was when the police gave the phone back and it was my daughter and my sister-in-law that actually discovered more within the phone. But none of us were aware. You know, we didn't even know she had this private account, so we had no access to it. My daughter had access to a lot of her apps, etc., but didn't even know this private account existed. And I think, you know, the algorithms play a huge part. She'd liked a lot of things within these platforms, and then they, you know, with these algorithms, which I wasn't aware of, they just send you more and more of the same thing that you like. And unfortunately, the months leading up to it, she'd liked posts on suicide, which I completely wasn't aware of until we lost her. And then with these algorithms, they just send you more of what you're liking. So yeah.
I can't even imagine, Gemma, that awful moment of realisation, and to know that that had been happening, that you didn't know about it, that it wasn't a conversation that you would have happily had with her had you known.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just to find that out must have been heartbreaking for you.
Absolutely. And as a parent, you know, I look at the fact that, you know, her dad was so against it, and I was, you know, unfortunately someone who didn't see the harm in it and thought, well, all of her friends are doing it. And yeah, I just wasn't aware, you know, and I'm sure there's parents out there that could think that I'm quite naive, but, and maybe I was, but, you know, when she was such a happily, confident, outgoing child, and I could hear her on the phone in her bedroom, on the phone to her friends and laughing and joking, and the amount she did go out. I mean, sometimes she'd like to be out a lot with her friends, and I, as a parent, you look at everything in terms of the external factors and think that you can protect them from the outside, and without realising that the danger is actually in their hands and, you know, at home. You know, I was completely unaware, and, you know, I obviously need to take some accountability for that. But, you know, the social media platforms absolutely need to take accountability for their responsibility and the lack of safeguarding as well.
Yeah, well, I know that the reason that you're doing this and you're having these really painful conversations is to try and warn other parents. And I know that you are backing now a ban for under 16s on social media. It's something that the government says it supports and it's pursuing. There's a trial at the moment in California. Meta, one of the big social media companies, is being sued by various US states who what they say they want is for some of the things you talked about, the algorithm, some of the things that might make social media apps addictive to be taken away.
Yeah, absolutely. The algorithms, the like counts. I think, you know, as children, you know, they, if they post something, they want there to see as many likes as possible, the removal of that. You know, there's so many safeguarding measures that need to be put in place to make these safe for, you know, for children. But, you know, the Raise the Age UK is so important to make sure that children don't have access to this. I mean, you know, children, you know, need to have access to a phone so that they can contact their friends, but it should just be completely minimal, and it shouldn't be these social media apps that are targeted to make you stay on the phone for hours on end and to be, you know, sort of scrolling through for hours and hours.
Gemma Best, I know it's not easy, and I really appreciate you speaking to us this morning. Thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, if you've been affected by any of the issues, any of the things that Gemma was talking about there, you can go to bbc.co.uk/actionline, or you can call 0800 155 947. The lines there are open 24 hours a day. All calls are free. Worth saying as well, I mentioned that Meta trial that's going on in the US at the moment, where US states want them to change some of those addictive features. Meta, as a company, is obviously rejecting the claim against it. They say that that case fails to show evidence of real world harm.
Mm-hmm. Now then, joining us now is Alex Forsyth to tell us more about tonight. Any questions? Morning, Alex. Where are you off to?
Hello, morning Simon, morning Anna. Tonight we will be in Bakewell in Derbyshire, where we might get a sense of what people make of Andy Burnham's first month in office, or perhaps it's Harry and Meghan's return to the UK they want to discuss. We are in the hands of our audience to take their questions, whatever they may be. We have James Frith, a minister in the Department for Health and Social Care. Nigel Huddleston is the Shadow Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport. Isabel Hardman is the Assistant Editor at The Spectator. And Zoe Williams is a columnist at The Guardian. We will be live at 8pm. Hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Let's get the weather now. Here's Thomas.
Anna, thank you. Very good morning to you. We're waking up to some beautiful weather this morning, especially across northern England. In fact, all the way from southern and central Scotland through the Lake District and right across Yorkshire. And there's plenty of sunny spells further south as well. There are also a few scattered showers in one or two spots, and we can expect further showers today. But there certainly won't be as many as yesterday, because yesterday we had quite a few downpours with some thunder and lightning. So what can we expect a little bit later on? Well, in Scotland and Northern Ireland, it'll be predominantly a dry day with sunny spells, just the odd shower. Most of the showers today will be across northern England, anywhere from the Pennines, eastern coastal counties, and also down to parts of Lincolnshire and maybe East Anglia. Elsewhere across England, it is going to be a predominantly dry day. And in Wales, sunny spells can be expected, especially across the north, and I think showers may develop around the Brecon Beacons. Now, today's top temperatures will reach around 22 Celsius on the south coast of England, 20 in the Midlands, and it'll be fresher across northern England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, closer to about 17 Celsius. Tonight, we've got clear spells on the way. It's going to turn quite fresh, and tomorrow morning, we're starting on a fresh and sunny note. A high pressure is building and it's going to be a dry day. And overall, the weekend is looking mostly sunny. That's it.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Simon Jack in London. It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 21st of August. The headlines this morning. Forecasters say the El Niño weather system is gathering unprecedented strength and could make next year the hottest on record. Spending on welfare and debt interest unexpectedly pushed up government borrowing in July, and sources close to the Sussexes are not denying reports that Meghan has been offered an acting role in a project based in the UK.
Also still to come on the programme, who's winning the war in Ukraine? As the country counts the cost of devastating strikes this week, can it hold out without access to more Patriot missiles? And what can European allies do about that? We'll speak to Poland's foreign minister after the news. And
it is a wonderful thing for our businessmen and our manufacturers and our unemployed to taste hope again, that they must not allow anyone to put them back in the gold cage, where they have been pining their hearts out all these years.
A new play examining the life, loves and legacy of the economist John Maynard Keynes is opening this week. So the actor Rory Kinnear will join us to talk about portraying one of the most influential thinkers of the 20th century and beyond. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
The Met Office is warning that a developing El Niño weather system is set to become the strongest in living memory, possibly since the 19th century. Forecasters say that combined with climate change, the phenomenon could result in next year being the hottest in recorded history. El Niño is a recurring climate pattern in the Pacific Ocean, which sees unusually warm waters boost the risk of extreme weather around the world. More details from our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The Met Office is warning sea temperatures in the central tropical Pacific could rise more than 3 degrees above normal in the coming months. That is far beyond the range of a typical El Niño. That matters because El Nino can shift weather patterns across the globe. Central America, tropical South America, and parts of Australia are among the regions at increased risk of drought. In the Atlantic, El Nino tends to suppress hurricanes. The Met Office says the event could increase the chances of wetter, stormier conditions across northwest Europe, including the UK, this autumn and early winter. It is also likely to push up global temperatures, which is why the Met Office said today that 2027 was very likely to overtake 2024 as the warmest year on record.
The head of long-range forecasts at the Met Office, Professor Adam Scaife, told us the current El Niño would have a direct effect on weather patterns across the world.
With climate change, it's very difficult to create cause and effect when you have a particularly extreme weather pattern. But we know these patterns from long series of historical observations and our latest computer simulations. So we can be very confident that it's the El Niño in the Pacific that is driving the drought that we see coming in South America over the Amazon region, that is driving these patterns that appear across the Atlantic in the coming months.
The Panama Canal Authority has announced restrictions on marine traffic through one of the world's most important waterways because of drought conditions fueled by El Niño. The number of vessels allowed to sail through will be cut in stages throughout September due to low water levels in artificial lakes that feed the canal. The operator has already reduced the maximum depth in the water for the largest ships. The UK borrowed £1.8 billion in July, about two-thirds more than in the same month last year. The Office for National Statistics said spending growth outpaced the money the government received from tax receipts. Our business correspondent Mark Ashdown reports.
July is typically a strong month for the government balance sheet, as self-assessed income tax receipts roll in. It received £17 billion from self-assessed taxpayers last month, £1.7 billion more than in July last year. But the amount being spent on debt interest, public services and benefits continues to rise. So overall, borrowing was higher than in the same month last year, and £2.3 billion above the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast. Debt at the end of July was equivalent to 94% of GDP, marginally less than a year earlier, but it remains at levels last seen in the early 1960s. The Chancellor, John Healey, said the government was cutting the deficit faster than any other G7 economy, while the Conservatives said more money was being spent on debt interest than on defence, police and prisons combined.
The Home Office says French police officers have stopped 185 small boats from crossing the Channel in the first 3 months of a new deal with Paris. Citing data from the authorities in France, the government says new tactics, including the deployment of a 50-strong riot squad, prevented more than 4,300 migrants from making the journey. Despite the increased enforcement activity, more than 8,000 people came to Britain on small boats over the same period. Our correspondent Tom Simons reports.
The government signed a new deal with France in April, paying more than £600 million for tougher policing on the other side of the Channel. Officials say more boat equipment is now being seized on the way to the coast, more dinghies are being intercepted and punctured on the beaches, and for the first time they're being stopped at sea, regarded as a safety risk in the past. Three boats were prevented from entering British waters in the last 2 weeks, having left the French coast. 61% of crossing attempts have been intercepted, but that's an increase of only 5% compared with the same period last year. The Conservatives said they would refuse asylum claims to small boat migrants, a policy which would mean leaving the European Convention on Human Rights.
Sources close to the Sussex family have not denied reports that Meghan has been offered an acting role in the UK. No details have been confirmed. Harry and Meghan are set to move into a private residence away from London within days. Here's our senior royal correspondent, Daniela Ralph.
The Duchess of Sussex put her acting career on hold after her marriage to Prince Harry. But reports in Australian media say she is going back to acting with a role in a UK-based entertainment project. And this is one of the reasons why the Sussex family is leaving America. Harry and Meghan's representatives are not denying the story, but aren't giving any details at this stage. As an actress, she was best known for her part in the US legal drama Suits, where she played Rachel Zane, a lawyer, for 7 seasons. A return to acting could be lucrative for Meghan. Interest will be high in whatever she does, as the UK return of the Sussexes continues to grab attention.
The Duke of Sussex and other high-profile claimants will get their first indication this afternoon of how much they might have to pay in legal costs after losing their privacy case against the publisher of the Daily Mail. The judge at the High Court said the group, including Sir Elton John and Liz Hurley, had failed to provide proof that the paper had gathered information on them unlawfully. The former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has been returned to prison after receiving a health check at a hospital in Islamabad. He's 3 years into a jail term for corruption. His supporters say the prosecution was political and his health is deteriorating. But Pakistan's information minister said a team of doctors had declared him medically fit. The UK is having its first national day for victims and survivors of terrorism, marked by a ceremony in London. It will consist of reflections and readings by victims, survivors and bereaved family members, including representatives of the emergency services. Campaigners have welcomed the event, but a report by the group Survivors Against Terror warns they're being let down by a lack of support and compensation. Jo Berry co-authored the report. Her father, Sir Anthony Berry, died when an IRA bomb exploded at the Conservative Party conference in Brighton in 1984. She told us today was a step forward for victims, but there was still a long way to go.
There are still areas which we're having to work on, and one of them is definitely compensation. There's some countries in Europe where it's just automatic, there's a way through. Also asking for like immediate financial assistance because people need that straight away. And in France, people just get a lump sum if they were there, and that just immediately takes care of some of the physical problems.
Dozens of people who spent thousands of pounds on luxury holidays have accused TUI River Cruises of operating vessels with faulty facilities, including persistently broken air conditioning. TUI has apologised to customers whose trips it said had fallen short of the standards it aimed to deliver. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The BBC previously reported the experiences of passengers on the TUI ship Skyler in Budapest in late June when the air conditioning failed during a heatwave. Many more river cruise goers have since contacted the BBC to report similar problems on other holidays, on Skyler and another vessel, Isla. In Isla's case, we've heard complaints about hot conditions as well as plumbing issues dating back to April 2025. Passengers have criticised TUI's customer service and said the partial refunds offered were inadequate. TUI River Cruises said it had experienced unexpected technical issues affecting air conditioning systems and that extensive repairs and maintenance work had been done. It added that it would be upgrading its air conditioning systems this winter.
A 15-foot python at Chester Zoo has become the first snake in the world to receive a cancer treatment normally used on humans. The snake, named after the actress Jodie Foster, was given electrochemotherapy treatment and had surgery to remove a tumour after staff at the zoo noticed she was struggling to eat. Lydia Dowling-Renera has the story.
2 years ago, Jodie Foster the python had surgery to remove a tumour from her jaw. But last year, the growth returned. After consulting with experts at the University of Liverpool, the veterinary team at Chester Zoo removed the tumour and part of the python's jawbone where the cancer had spread. They then used electrochemotherapy to target the remaining cancerous cells in what's believed to be a medical first for snakes. Vets at Chester Zoo said Jodie Foster was back to her bright and feisty self after treatment and hope she'll go on to live many more healthy years.
Lydia Dowling-Renera reporting.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 10 minutes past eight. Who is winning the war in Ukraine? While its forces are now hitting targets deeper than ever before inside Russia, the impact of dwindling stocks of protective missiles is being felt hard inside its own borders. That's the sound of rescuers working to clear rubble in the aftermath of another direct hit on Kyiv. Ukraine relies on Patriot interceptors donated by its allies to bring down Russian missiles, but international stocks have been depleted, particularly by the war in Iran. And countries who have them need to keep a certain amount in stock at home, both for their own protection and to meet NATO commitments. But that means that Ukraine's key line of defence has been severely weakened. Yesterday, at least 17 people were killed by Russian attacks in Kyiv, and a school and a children's hospital were both damaged. Each additional Patriot missile saves the lives of our people, President Zelensky has said. And he insists that the war will not end without them, saying as long as Ukraine does not have enough anti-ballistics, Russia will not seriously think about peace. Which brings us back, doesn't it, to that original question. Who is winning the war in Ukraine? Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, joins us. Jeremy, good morning. Is that a question we can answer?
Not definitively, no, I don't think so. It's still a war of attrition, but it's changing. It's more fluid. It's escalating in different ways on the Eastern Front, where we've had a lot of focus over the years. It's very destructive, a lot of men getting killed, but it's also relatively stable because of the fact that both sides are so adept at using drones. But as you've been saying, Russia has a major plus, which is that Ukraine is running out of interceptors, especially Patriots. And last winter was very tough as Russia targeted energy and heating plants. And this winter is going to be worse in that sense, I would say. Putin will up the pressure to try and force concessions, even capitulation. He's not short of ballistic missiles. And, of course, he'll be looking with delight as well at the political stress inside Ukraine, the conflict between President Zelensky and his former defense minister, Mr. Fedorov, who wants elections. And that's something, that kind of stress is something which I think the Russians will welcome. There's an interesting article, in fact, in the journal Foreign Affairs from experts at the Carnegie Eurasia Center, saying that he's got hopes of making life so hard in Putin, so hard in Ukraine this winter, that a new wave of refugees heads west, increasing support for hard right parties in Europe he sees as Russia's allies. But of course, Ukraine has got its own pluses, not least the fact their deep strikes inside Russia are causing deep pain as well to the economy, and also isolating, or trying to isolate, occupied Crimea.
When we look, Jeremy, at some of those challenges, and particularly the lack of interceptors available to Ukraine, it is enormously difficult to get around that, really, isn't it? Countries need to keep them. They cannot be and are not manufactured quickly. It's difficult to see what the solution to that might be.
Well, there is a major problem in the overall model of the way that Western defence, or many countries anyway, has been built, which is the fact that the idea that you can have missile defence, what the Iran war has shown is that these so-called exquisite missiles that cost millions, they sometimes have to use two or three of them to take down a drone, which costs about the same as a decent second-hand car. And when it comes to ballistic missiles, and the Russians can produce, some estimates say, up to 100 ballistic missiles a month, then the only thing that's going to do it are the Patriots. The Ukrainians haven't got them. Even a few years ago, they were always having shortages. I was in Kharkiv in the northeast of the country when it had no Patriots, and the Russians were bombing it pretty much, you know, hitting it with missiles pretty much at will. And that is going to be many times repeated, I think, over the winter. And that is a big problem for the Ukrainians. Now, some European countries do have stocks. Apparently the Greeks have some, the Spaniards have some. Britain doesn't, because we never bought them. But will they give those to Ukraine, or will they think, well, hang on a minute, this is a dangerous world, we need to hang on to our own missile defences?
Yeah, and that's the key question, isn't it? Jeremy Bowen, our international editor, thank you for joining us this morning. Listening to that, Radek Sikorski, a Poland's foreign minister and deputy prime minister. Good morning. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning.
How do you see, and approaching it from the political position that you stand in, how do you see some of those challenges being solved, particularly, as Jeremy was saying, they're in a difficult and dangerous world? European allies are very prepared to support Ukraine, but can they give away their own protective interceptors in doing that?
I think it's important to explain to our listeners what the difference between a ballistic and a cruise missile is. So a cruise missile is essentially a pilotless plane moving up to 1,000 kilometers per hour, usually very low to avoid detection by radar. And that you can take out with an anti-aircraft missile from an F-16 or a MiG-29 or what have you. A ballistic missile is like the V-2. It goes very high into the edge of outer space and then comes down at 4 or 5 times the speed of sound. Those are the kinds of missiles that rained on London and Britain from November 44 and actually killed around 10,000 British people during World War II. And in some horrific incidents, 160 people at one go. And those are inherently more difficult to take down because they move so fast. You can't do it with an aircraft missile. You can't do it with a machine gun. What you need is the most sophisticated anti-ballistic missiles. Essentially, the most effective ones are PAC-3. And the problem is that Russia produces more ballistic missiles than the United States produces PAC-3s. And so and here we are at a crunch point when Ukraine has run out of effectors of PAC-3 missiles for their PAC batteries. So you would think that the way to defend Ukraine would be to strike the factories that make the Russian ballistic missiles. But for that, you would need decisions by essentially Western European countries that have stocks of Taurus missiles, of Storm Shadows, to allow Ukraine to strike deep into Russia, into military targets.
But politically, at what point, I'm keen to know the sorts of decisions that people like you are making in those rooms where conversations are happening, where Ukraine are making it very, very clear that they need this weaponry from their European allies. But again, as we were saying, in a more dangerous world, it can't be simply given away or handed over so those donating countries exhaust their own supply. So how do you balance those competing issues?
So, of course, the biggest stocks traditionally were held by the producer, which is to say the United States. There are numbers of them, and I can't reveal too much. And some of them will be delivered by our West European allies. Poland is in a special position. We are a frontline state ourselves, and we have Russian both cruise and cruise missiles and Russian drones breaching our airspace. So we have to be extra careful. But there is an effort at NATO to compute, to gather together a stock of missiles to tide Ukraine over the winter.
Are these tricky decisions for you to make, particularly where you are, as we were saying there in Poland, so close to what is happening in Ukraine?
Yes, they are, because, you know, our people can hear explosions on the Ukrainian side of the border in southeastern Poland. And, of course, our people expect our Air Force to protect our airspace, and that these timings are very short. You know, we had a cruise missile breaching our airspace about a month ago. Within 6 minutes, it penetrated 100 kilometers deep into Poland.
As you say, Radek Sikorski, some real challenges for Ukraine, but also for European allies to deal with as well. Thank you for joining us this morning, Poland's Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister.
It is 20 past eight, just gone. Now, there are not many economists who are household names, apart from maybe one.
It is a wonderful thing for our businessmen and our manufacturers and our unemployed to taste hope again, that they must not allow anyone to put them back in the gold cage where they have been pining their hearts out all these years.
John Maynard Keynes there, talking about the end of the gold standard. Now, he was an international superstar in the field of economics, and his ideas helped shape global economic thinking after the First World War and beyond. He also lived a very colourful personal life as part of the Bloomsbury Group, a group of artists, writers and thinkers with, for the time at least, pretty radical ideas about how life should be lived. And Keynes is the subject of a new drama cleverly called The Standard of Living, which tracks Keynes' public and personal life as old economic and moral values change. It starts at the Theatre Royal Haymarket on the 21st of September. And Rory Kinnear, award-winning actor, is playing John Maynard Keynes and joins us here in the studio. And someone who would narrowly be second, I think, on many people's list of household economic names, Stephanie Flanders, senior executive editor for economics at Bloomberg, former BBC economics editor, of course, and made a documentary on Keynes back in 2012. Welcome both. Rory, can I ask you first, how much did you know about this character before?
I think I knew the adjective, and I think Keynesian economics came into the public consciousness throughout 2008 in the response to the financial crisis and that. But I don't think I knew much beyond that. I certainly didn't know the wide variety of interests and the colourful life that led behind the man.
And what is the character, the Keynes, that we meet in this production?
So we're meeting him in 1914 to start with, and we go through to the end of his life in 1946. A man in his 30s who's been called to London at the start of the war to help out. And he was someone who was on the fringes of the establishment, as it were. I mean, he was himself firmly establishment as being an Etonian and Cambridge graduate, but on the fringes of it in terms of accepted thought, and he's seeming a bit of a wild card, but they thought such was the problems that they were facing that it was time to play the wild card. And we see him go through the Paris Peace Conference after the First World War, not quite get what he hoped, not quite able to convince the powers that they didn't need to be as punitive to Germany as he saw them going to be, and he knew what this would lead to, and which indeed did come true with the rise of Hitler. And going into 1946, going to the Bretton Woods Peace Conference and trying to make the case once again that that a new world could be built out of the ashes of the old.
Okay, and so Stephanie Flanders, you talked about the adjective there. Rory said he knew Keynesian. Tell us what it means. What's the gist of it?
What the change that Keynes produced and managed to spread across the world was to instill the idea that economies could just get stuck. Before he wrote in the 20s and 30s, you had series of, you know, booms and busts, depressions through, you know, hundreds of years of economic history. And the most recent sort of view of policymakers was you just had to sort of grin and bear it. This was a sort of cleansing thing that economies would go through, and eventually, you know, prices would fall enough, wages would fall enough, and things would come back. And that was something that even like the first Labour government in the 20s had thought, and thought that you had to balance the budget in the face of these kind of things, and you'd have to keep raising taxes. And he said, no, you can get just stuck in a slump where no one is expecting things to get better. They think demand's just going to continue to fall, and that's going to carry on until the government steps in. But the government has the capacity to step in and actually bring the economy out of it, bring back the animal spirits, as we talk about, you know, and Simon, you've often talked about in the financial markets. And that was just a massive shift, which then spread around the world. And even as we've had debates in the last sort of few decades about, you know, cutting the budget deficit here and there, never enough probably, that's still on the margins. We're all Keynesians in the sense that we all think the government should get involved when the economy
goes
downhill.
We're all Keynesians now. So basically run deficits during recessions because the government can play a part in keeping the economy on track. Is he does he enjoy his life? Does he feel fulfilled, Rory?
Well, he's someone who had an incredible number of interests. And yes, obviously there was the economic and political thought that he spent his life trying to convince people of. But he also had most of his friends were the Bloomsbury Group. He spent most of his summers in Charleston, took a house near to Charleston himself later on.
This was quite a wild crowd for the time, wasn't it?
Yes, those people, wild we might these days see as being a muted term for them, but they were trying to at least put all of social mores and norms under a microscope and questioning whether or not they were actually important. And he was inspired in his work by as much as their work gave him. And the fact that, I mean, he set up the Arts Council in the last year of his life. He was passionate about the art. He married a ballerina and I think was responsible for the Royal Ballet being founded as well. well.
So. He also had, no, just because he had his finger in so many pies, and he actually sometimes had a crossover between the economics and the arts. So there's this fantastic, after the war, when he was working at the Treasury, after World War One, he saw there was all this debt that the French were going to pay back with useless francs because they were going to have to devalue because they had no money after the war. He said, no, what we'll do, we've seen actually there's Cezanne and various other estates auctions coming up for auction. We should use, he got the Treasury to give him money to go and buy that art and take the art, which then went up enormously in value instead of the worthless French currency.
And that was Duncan Grant who said, I've heard of the Degas' collection is going under the hammer. You should go over there and we'll persuade the country to buy it for the country.
And it's sitting in the National Gallery, some of that.
Reminds me of, we were talking, Greece was still talking about selling off some of its antiquities during the Eurozone crisis. Now, I understand this play came together actually because of a Radio 4 programme, is that right?
Well, yes, and we're here to give thanks. It was James Graham, our writer, was appearing on Great Lives and talking about Keynes with Matthew Paris, and Nick Heitner, our director, was listening and thought, that sounds like an incredible life and one that would make a great play, and I think I know just the playwright to write it.
Mm. And Stephanie, that Keynes' ideas, if and like, got really tried out fully in the aftermath, which people remember, of the financial crisis. This was a kind of moment where people would say, let's hope Keynes was right. Let's go for it.
No, that was a classic moment. And I think the great phrase then was, everyone's a Keynesian in a foxhole. So when you're really in trouble, everyone, even if they've sort of spoken about free markets needing to get away from excessive government borrowing, when it came down to it, even though the US did have something of a deficit already, President Obama had a $700-800 billion bailout for the economy, and there was even discussion that it should be higher. I think, you know, that has kind of ratcheted up. We saw that again with COVID, and I think one thing that the Keynesians have not been able to deal with is the issue of inflation, and that was, you know, we're now starting to see that again.
Yeah,
and he did think you should balance the books when the sun was shining.
Okay, fix the roof.
We've seen less of
fix the roof while the sun is shining. I wonder what he would have made of the $40 trillion US debt we're seeing at the moment. A final thought from you, Rory. Is it difficult? Is it different playing someone who's a historical figure rather than someone
fiction? Well, in some ways it's easier because their biography has been written for you, so you don't have to create it for yourself, which you would usually have to do if you were working for a character of fiction. So you can read the books and you've sort of done your research, or in my case you just have to grow a moustache.
Yes, well, I see. Okay, sporting that today. Well, after Lehman Brothers was a smash hit on the stage, now this, you know, Stephanie, you should become a playwright as well as an economist. But Rory Kinnear, Stephanie Flanders, thank you very much. And it opens again on the Theatre Royal Haymark on the 21st of September. Thank you.
Just coming round to 29 minutes past eight now. And on the way, after the news, the strongest El Nino in living memory could put the UK at a greater risk of a wet and stormy autumn. So what can we do to avert the risk of flooding just after a long hot summer? We'll find out.
But first of all, let's get some sport with Mike. And the Premier League is back this evening. It seems too soon.
Yes, didn't we miss it, Simon? Before we know it, a brand new Premier League season is upon us. And as you say, it begins this evening. The curtain raiser sees defending champions Arsenal host newly promoted Coventry City at the Emirates. I'm delighted to say that the owner and chairman of Coventry City, Doug King, is with us live in the studio this morning. Hi, Doug.
Good morning.
Many thanks for coming and really appreciate you taking the time out on what will be a very busy day for you and your club. Coventry's first match back in the top flight for a quarter of a century. And what a nice easy start you've got. Away to the champions.
Yeah, they made it special. They made it memorable. Obviously, champions against the champions. We're down in London. 3,000 or 4,000 will come down and support us in the big giant stadium. But we're excited for it. It's been a long time coming. 4 months since we were promoted. But we're ready.
I want to ask you about your manager, Frank Lampard, one of the biggest Premier League players of the last 20 years, of course. You appointed him as your manager about 20 months or so ago when Coventry was 17th in the Championship. And really, you've never looked back since, have you? You won the league, as you say, last year, champions of the Championship. And here you are back in the big time. What's that working relationship like with Frank?
Well, obviously, it was hugely unpopular at the time. We had Mark Robbins there for a number of years, and the fans had grown to love him, and rightly so, for what he'd done. We made the change, and Frank came in. Obviously, it's quite awkward when you're following somebody who's done so well. But he, from the get-go, was on it. The results, obviously, showed that. We came from 17th and made it through to the playoff semi-final. And we were very unfortunate to lose to Sunderland. And obviously then we had the season of seasons. And, you know, I get on great with him. He's very intelligent, very smart, very logical. And he's really got the players playing how we want them to play and feeling that they can take on anybody and make a difference. So I've been really, you know, it's been a great 18, 20 months with him.
And he and you have had a busy summer, haven't you? Coventry have broken their record transfer fee several times over the last few weeks, a reported spend of around £130 million. Yet, you will know, the gulf in spending between the top and bottom clubs in the Premier League is still massive, isn't it? How do you surmount that?
I mean, they're scary numbers, aren't they, when you put it like that? Look, I think when a club is promoted, they need to reset their quality of players to go with what's got them there in the first place. And I think we've tried to do that, to bring in the quality that will allow us to compete. But clearly, when you're first up there, the sort of odds say that, you know, seven out of the last nine have gone straight back down again. So I'm not in any sort of dreamland. This is going to be easy, but we had to get our squad set up. And I feel that we've had a good summer for that. So I'm feeling happy that we've recruited really well.
You've been getting to know a lot of your new fellow chairs in the Premier League. I know recently you were at the launch a few days ago, and you probably have seen this quote from the chief executive of the Premier League, Richard Masters, where he said every club should aspire to win the Premier League. I mean, they're nice words, aren't they? But in truth, that's pie in the sky talk, isn't it, for a club like Coventry?
Look, you can aspire, but the reality is, you know, the rules and the squad cost ratio, where your revenue and your turnover determines how much you can spend on your players and your transfers, means that somebody like Coventry, who's come up, will have, I know, revenues of 160 million versus the top team's 800 million. Yeah, it's not going to work. Now, you have to build up those revenues over time, but the reality is it's a close shot pretty much at the top of the tree, and that's the truth. But look, he wants to have some excitement. He's a good man. Premier League is a competitive league versus a lot of other leagues around the world, especially in Europe. And so, look, Leicester City won in 10 years ago, right? So you've got a dream.
Yeah, and there are some success stories as well to look at. This time 12 months ago, everyone was predicting Sunderland to go back down, and they finished seventh. So you can defy the doubters, I guess. I want to ask you about yourself. You made your name in renewable energy before coming into football, and you are relatively new to the sport compared to some of your fellow Premier League chairs. You bought Coventry 3 years ago, I think. What has surprised you about working in football in comparison to some of the other industries you've worked in?
I would say it's fast. It goes fast. The season is very quick, defined. It can get out of control, and players are on contracts. And if it doesn't work in 18 months, they're sort of turning over. So huge turnover that you have to manage as effectively as you possibly can. I think you need really strong controls, business controls on your costs. And obviously you've got to try and sell the dream and get your revenues moving. So it's a really challenging business. You need to trade well, and I'm a trader by background. So buying and selling human capital is important. You have to buy low and sell high, to put it bluntly. But it's enjoyable. It's fast moving. It matters. You know, for the big thing about football, it matters. And our city is absolutely red hot for what's going to go down tonight.
Well, as a final point, briefly, I was just going to ask your city, what does it mean to Coventry to have a top flight team again?
Listen, the city is, you can't believe it, walking around, all the shirts are out, sales are through the roof, 100% up. Football and sport matter, right? They really do. And we haven't had it for so long that the pent-up sort of excitement is spilling over. Maybe we'll have around 10, 15,000 come down just to be around the Emirates today. That would be awesome.
You're going to beat Arsenal tonight?
Let's leave it there.
Okay, we shall see. Enjoy your night out at the Emirates. It is the Premier League curtain raiser to the brand new season this evening at the Emirates. Champions Arsenal against newly promoted Coventry City. Our thanks this morning to the Coventry owner and chairman, Doug King, for joining us live in the studio.
That's one to look forward to, isn't it? Thank you, Mike. It is 25 to 9. Here's Lauren Laverne to tell us about a very musical guest on today's Desert Island Discs.
My castaway this week is the singer and songwriter Chaka Khan.
He said, "How am I going to make you famous if you're going to be having babies?" I said, "I'll tell you what, I'll be having babies with you, without you, over you or under you. I'm just going to do my life."
The singer and songwriter Chaka Khan is my castaway on Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
Tell me something good. Tell me that you love me.
You're listening to Today with Anna Foster in Salford, Simon Jack in London, and at 25 to 9, Caroline Nichols has the last look at the news.
The Met Office is warning that the El Niño weather system in the Pacific could become the strongest since the 19th century. The forecaster says the recurring climate phenomenon could make 2027 the hottest year on record. Government borrowing was £1.8 billion in July, two-thirds higher than in the same month last year, and £2.3 billion above the official forecast. Spending on welfare and debt interest outpaced self-assessed tax receipts. The Home Office says French police officers prevented 185 small boats from crossing the Channel in the 3 months after a new deal was signed with Paris in April. Despite the increased enforcement activity, more than 8,000 people came to Britain on small boats over the same period. Reports in Australian media say the Duchess of Sussex is returning to acting and has secured a role in the UK ahead of the Sussex family's move back to England in a few weeks. Meghan's team are not denying the claims.
Caroline, thank you. El Niño, as you were hearing there in the headlines, the weather phenomenon that sees water temperatures in the Pacific rise, which affects weather patterns all around the world, is shaping up to be its most extreme in living memory. We heard in the last hour from the Met Office long-range forecaster that we could see droughts in Central and South America, the Panama Canal is low on water, and the autumn in Europe and the UK is predicted to be wet and stormy.
This event, I have not seen an event like this developing in our forecasts before. And assuming the forecasts are correct and many other centres are giving the same signals, then we're expecting the biggest El Niño for over a century, peaking at something over 3 degrees. That is unheard of in modern climate records.
Well, that was Professor Adam Scaife, the head of long-range forecasting at the Met Office. Let us talk now to Emma Howard-Boyd, former chair of the Environment Agency from 2016 to 2022, now based at the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and the Environment. Good morning to you, Emma.
Good morning.
I would like to try and narrow in. We heard some dread warnings there about droughts in Central and South America and a wet and windy, stormy season for Northern Europe. How prepared, and you know, we have now been warned, how prepared are we for the season ahead?
Well, the words that Adam Scaife chose were really stark. And what I think he and the Met Office have given us is this window of opportunity to make sure that we are as prepared as possible for the events that they are forecasting for this autumn. And I think we heard from the Prime Minister that when he met with COBRA recently on the heat waves, that he had had a briefing for this autumn. So I think it's incumbent on all of the agencies, departments working on preparation for this winter to really set out clearly what that means, particularly given the way our landscape has been hardened by the weeks and months of dry weather. And that flip-flopping from an incredibly wet end of last year into this year, this incredibly dry and hot summer, that the flood defences that we have up and down this country are at the level of readiness to experience what, by all accounts, could be a very unprecedented amount of weather hitting us this autumn.
Have you had experience of this? I mean, when we've had previous El Niños before, has that followed, you know, with periods of flooding in your experience when you were at the EA?
Well, the period I remember most, the winter of 2015, 2016, when we had a series of storms, Storm Desmond, Eva and Frank over that winter coincided with a period of El Niño. And this caused devastating impacts across the country. Now, since then, the Environment Agency and other agencies working on flood across the whole of the country have been investing in flood defences. But that investment is what we need to make sure is that we are prepared for what could be even greater flood events, and make sure that our communities are ready for these events too.
Is this sort of buying extra sandbags? Is it helping rivers deviate, so they wind a bit more? What are some of the flood defence protections we can do?
I think it's also understanding which parts of our infrastructure are going to be most vulnerable. And I think we do need a focus on people. So understanding where care homes, hospitals, schools may be at flood risk. I know that organisations like the National Emergencies Trust are working with the Cabinet Office to work on more general communications around preparedness. But we have these months now to make sure that at every level of government, whether it is national, regional, we're thinking about the preparedness that exists. There are a range of committees that sit across England that bring together the work of the Environment Agency, DEFRA, and the Communities Department to get ready at that community level. We have Local Resilience Forum. We have now several weeks ahead of us to plan for these short-term impacts.
Now, one thing that you will have come across in the Environment Agency, and one thing which is on a lot of people's mind when it comes to water supply, is when you get flooding, you get sewage discharge. And so what we are, we keep being told it'll take years to fix this. So we should be bracing ourselves for more of that. Obviously, that's something that comes under the Environment Agency's purview.
That could be part of the mix, but I am just as focused on all of the infrastructure that exists across this country, whether it is our schools, our transport networks, our hospitals. This is a health risk, the weather that we are potentially going to experience. This is an economic risk, and this is a national security risk. We need to think about food, food supplies, and how this can impact individuals from a cost of living perspective. So I think the main thing that I want to emphasize is take this out of the environment, make this a national effort to get ready for this winter, because the warnings that we've heard from the Met Office, the warnings we've heard from other meteorological specialists are get prepared and think as broadly as possible what this might mean.
Yeah. And do you think that things like the Thames flood barrier, what have you, and, you know, big infrastructure projects, is that what the kind of thing approach we need, or flood walls or what have you? And is that coming out of government funding? Can you get private sector investment? What's the blueprint for how you gear up for what is, you know, the warnings that we've had?
So when you start moving to the long-term investment that is needed across the country to prepare for the range of climate impacts that we're now experiencing, one of the ways that will help draw in private sector investment is by setting standards and by setting duties. This is something that mayors of combined authorities have called for. This is something that agencies have called for. And whilst there is a programme of investment that has been set out by the Environment Agency and others for the Thames Estuary, the Thames Estuary 2100 programme, that is not yet put on a statutory footing. Right. So it becomes difficult to raise the money that we need to invest over the years to come. So where, and it's the same for preparing for heat waves, we have many departments setting out 10-year strategies for investment. Within those budgets for investment into our infrastructure, we need to make sure that we are prioritising a preparedness for these sorts of events and ensuring that those are duties and therefore that will help make that investment happen.
Understood. Emma Howard-Boyd from the Grantham Research Institute on Climate Change and Environment and former chair of the Environment Agency. Thank you.
16 minutes to nine. Bereaved partners of victims of the UK's infected blood scandal have been asked to repay compensation payments of up to £10,000 that were made in error. Despite receiving the money 5 years ago now, they've been told to hand it back. And if they can't, a letter requesting the money says that it will be taken directly from their ongoing support payments. In 2021, the rules changed, saying that only people whose partners died after 2017 would qualify for the particular lump sum payment from this scheme, which would exclude those whose loved ones died before that date. Since this was raised, the government says it's suspended requests while the right and fair outcome is considered. Well, one of the people who got that letter is Lucy, not her real name. She received a lump sum of £10,000 in 2021, and she told me how the infected blood scandal led to her husband's death.
So he was a haemophiliac, so he received blood products that were infected It could be in the 70s, it could be in the 80s, we don't know when. And then he died as a result in 1995.
So after all of the paperwork and the support that you'd had from various different organisations, when you were offered this lump sum of money in 2021 of £10,000, that felt to you like some kind of a small piece of justice, at least, for what you had gone through?
Yes, because since my husband had died, I did get a small, I think it was £100 a month for about 6 months after he died. And that was it. And I put all that behind me after my husband died. So when I got the £10,000, it felt quite strange, really, that actually had been recognised that something had been done wrong.
And then when the next thing that you received, 5 years or so later, was a letter saying that that had been a mistake, an error, and that you needed to give that £10,000 back, that must have been a confusing and probably quite a scary moment, actually, because I don't know if you even still have that money there to hand back.
Well, I received an email on the 21st of July. It was like a real slap in the face, saying that we know it's our error. I was only eligible to apply for that payment within 6 months of his death. And because the payments only started from 2016, when the scheme started, I wasn't eligible. So I was really upset. Obviously, I'd used that money ages ago to pay part of my mortgage off, not for anything frivolous. And I just thought, well, hold on, why do I have to pay it back? Because he died after a certain timescale. He still died because of infected blood. Why am I any less widowed? Because he died in 95 and not 2016 or 17 or after that. So I was very confused.
They also told you in this letter that if you didn't have that money to pay back, that they would instead recover it from ongoing support payments.
Yes. And they completely admitted it was their fault, because on the application form they asked for the date of death, which obviously was 1995. How can something so fundamental like a date of death not be picked up at that time? And then to tell me 5 years later, and I wasn't the only one.
Well, that's what Lucy has been experiencing over these last few weeks. Samantha May is Helpline Information and Support Service Manager from the Hepatitis C Trust. Morning, Samantha.
Good morning, Anna.
So the point that Lucy was making there is that this is the worst treatment disaster, or it's certainly regarded as the worst treatment disaster in NHS history. Her husband died because of it, and nobody is disputing that. But this letter that she received said because she didn't claim within 6 months of his death that she had to hand back this money, which, as she said there, she got 5 years ago and has already spent.
Yeah, it absolutely beggars belief. Certainly we've been in contact with a few other people who've received this letter. I understand 12 people have been identified. I'm unclear if there's more. But so many years later, if it was one mistake that's been made, but the fact that there's 12 people already been identified, how did that happen? And when that's been discovered and they've decided to follow up, was any concern or consideration given to the impact on those people who've received this letter many years later?
The emotional really and the financial impact as well, because as she was saying there, and it says, you know, we do not expect you to repay the full amount in one payment. Because you're getting a support payment, we can instead reduce it until the full overpaid amount has been recovered. But if you're at a stage in life when you're receiving a pension, for example, or whatever it might be, you can't necessarily afford to lose that money every month.
Absolutely. I mean, many people that we speak to are totally reliant on these support payments for their sort of everyday monthly costs. So something like a large repayment, I understand they have to repay before March 27, is going to have a significant impact on them. you know, aside from the emotional shock, I just can't imagine what it was like for people waking up one morning recently and having a letter on their doorstep, you know, bringing all of these deeply upsetting feelings about what happened to their loved ones again, not being recognised. I mean, as Lucy was describing, hoping for some sort of resolution at the end of all of this, and yet they've just been torn up yet again. This community has continually been given misinformation and confusing information. They need peace. They need justice. They need to have this situation resolved as soon as possible.
Just as a final brief thought, Samantha, if anybody else has received this letter, the government says it's pausing it for the moment, but if somebody has one, doesn't know what to do, what advice would you give them?
I'd certainly encourage them to get in contact with organisations like ourselves so we can give them the support and guidance that they need with this. I'm very concerned that there may be already people in this community, often very isolated and stigmatised, and don't have other family support around them. They've been to hell and back already. And the thought that some people may be sitting at home with this letter in their hands is very disturbing. So I'd encourage them to get in contact with us. I mean, and another point is the wider community, you know, as I've described, so many people for so many decades have been given poor information, misinformation, promises have been made, promises have been broken already. This will have a knock-on effect on the many thousands of other people who are coming forward for compensation, who have already got sort of considerable and, I suppose, anticipatory distress and mistrust about the process that they're about to embark on. Yeah, this will not help matters, so I hope there's a swift conclusion to it.
Yes, the story will continue to follow. Thank you, Samantha. Samantha May from the Hepatitis C Trust.
8 minutes to 9.
As we heard in the news a little earlier, sources close to Prince Harry and his family have not denied reports that Meghan has been offered an acting role in the UK and that that might have played some part in their decision to return to the country in the next few weeks. The journalist behind that report is Bronte Coy, senior entertainment and royal correspondent at the Australian outlet news.com.au. Bronte, hello. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So this is something that you'd heard whispers about, but now you've had it confirmed that actually there is an acting job that Meghan is planning to take up when the family get back to the UK.
Well, yes. And you know what? This is such a key part of the puzzle. And I think when we all heard that news that Harry and Meghan were moving here and within a matter of days and the kids were enrolled in school, everyone was asking, well, what is Meghan going to be doing? Is she keen on returning to royal life or what will her career look like in the UK? And I think this here answers a lot of that now. I had heard rumours that potentially she'd be stepping into the acting world a little bit more. We saw a sign of that actually late last year when it emerged that she had filmed a cameo as herself in a big upcoming movie with Jack Quaid and Lily Collins. But this is obviously a massive step now back into that direction. And again, this is clearly part of why they've decided now to relocate over here with the kids, because either she has signed or is about to sign on for this project. I'm told it's significant and she's very excited about it.
But we don't know exactly what it is. And when we look at the fairly scant level of detail that we do have, the fact that the children will be enrolled in school might be telling, because things like Hollywood blockbuster movies or TV shows, they tend to be filmed reasonably quickly now in just a couple of months. So it could be a longer term role, a longer lasting role, perhaps.
You're exactly right. I mean, this has clearly been a top secret operation as conversations have been undergoing regarding Meghan being in this project, which is why we don't have those details. But I think you're exactly right to say that, because what we can glean is that if they are going to be here for what we're told is an extended period of time, it does indicate that it would be a lengthier project, possibly a show. So that's the kind of thing I think we will find out relatively soon, because if it is now at the point where she is signing on, I know this project is definitely happening, because as I say, it is it's a big part of why they wanted to move over here. There's also obviously Harry's connection to the UK and wanting to spend time with his wider family. But this is a big part of it. So I think that you're exactly right too. We can glean that from this information and from the fact they'll be here. But I do think that we will find out exactly what it is, you know, relatively soon.
Yeah, we'll await those further details. Bronte Coy from news.com.au, who broke that story. Thank you for joining us.
Now, Great Expectations has been reimagined to reflect the way teenagers speak today. It's been fed into an AI model and translated into Gen Z slang. Here's the original
My father's family name being Pirrip and my Christian name Philip, my infant tongue could make of both names nothing longer or more explicit than Pip. So I called myself Pip and came to be called Pip. I give Pirrip as my father's family name on the authority of his tombstone and my sister, Mrs. Jo Gargery, who married the blacksmith. As I never saw my father or my mother and never saw any likeness of either of them, for their days were long before the days of photographs. My first fancies regarding what they were like were unreasonably derived from their tombstones.
And here is the Gen Z version.
So I called myself Pip, ICL. I can't lie. It's not exactly a name with much riz, but here we are. I never knew my parents. I'd only ever seen their gravestones in the churchyard down in the marshes. Proper bleak vibes, all mist and sadness. I used to stare at the headstones trying to imagine what they looked like, which was bare brain rot behaviour when you think about it. Just me, standing in a graveyard, doom-scrolling through my own trauma. It was on one such evening, Christmas Eve, no less, that my life went mad delulu.
Well, that is Chazzy D, Charles Dickens. Another note. Lucinda Dickens-Hawksley is the author of several books on Charles Dickens. She's also the great-great-great-granddaughter of the celebrated novelist and his wife, Catherine. I hope I've got the right number of greats
you
in
have,
there.
Lucinda, have absolutely, I? Okay. Yes, you have. Hello.
Dare I ask what you make of this?
Well, I mean, I think it's always great to have Dickens reinterpreted. I think people get really hidebound by, oh, we have to just stick to the original. As long as the original is always kept and able to be studied, I think it's great to bring Dickens out for a new generation. I just think that maybe people aren't as all hidebound to the Generation Z tech speak as we think they are.
Mm. I mean, the idea of Pip chasing Aura, having Riz... do we lose something in that translation? I mean, I guess the thing is, it's all very well having modern words, but as long as they're accurate, as whether they, you know, sort of convey the original meaning.
Yeah, I mean, I read an article that said that this version was so that parents could understand what their Generation Z children were talking about. And it just really made me laugh. I love the fact that every single parent apparently knows Great Expectations well enough to be able to translate it. I mean, that's a great idea. I just don't know that that's always true. I think, joking aside, I think it's a great thing to have Dickens reinterpreted because every generation learns a new Dickens. I mean, we have so many different adaptations of things, such as A Christmas Carol. Every year there's a new one. I do think we need to look at the fact that this was written with AI. So does AI actually know what Generation Z is talking about? Mm-hmm. And I'd also like to point out that AI like Anthropic and Meta have actually taken without permission or payment works of many authors, including me.
Yeah.
And I think that they couldn't have written this without having scraped perhaps words by Generation Z authors. So that's something that really does need to be looked at. We can joke about it and say it's a good gimmick, but AI is a real issue for real working authors.
Copyright and intellectual property and all that kind of stuff.
What would Dickens have thought of that, of his work being rewritten not by a Generation Z author, which would be great. By a bot. I don't know. I find that very uncomfortable. But I love this retelling of Dickens.
Yeah. You mentioned it yourself that, you know, how many times has Christmas Carol been done over again? How many times has Great Expectations? Why has his work been adapted so many times over the years? What is it about the work that still captures each generation?
But this is whatever interpretation is done, Dickens wrote great plots, and that is what's always going to work. As long as you get the plot right, it's when people take great works, classic works, and they rewrite them and give them their own ending because they didn't like the original or whatever it might be. I think that kind of is a bit frustrating because then you're not really sticking with the essence of it. But what I love about Dickens is his characters stand the test of time.
They sure do. I think most people could name a whole fistful of